Chapter 6. January 1770. In Queen Charlotte's Sound, New Zealand. Right bracket, Tuesday, 16th. Variable light airs and clear settled weather. At 1 p.m. all close round the southwest end of the island, on which stands the village before mentioned, the inhabitants of which were all in arms. At 2 o'clock we anchored in a very snug cove, Ship Cove, in Queen Charlotte's Sound, which is on the northwest side of the bay facing the southwest end of the island in 11 fathoms, soft ground, and moored with a stream anchor. By this time several of the natives had come off to the ship in their canoes, and after heaving a few stones at us, and having some conversation with Tupia, some of them ventured on board, where they made but a very short stay, before they went into their canoes again, and soon after left us altogether. I then went ashore in the bottom of the cove, accompanied by most of the gentlemen on board. We found a fine stream of excellent water, and as to wood the land is here one interforest. Having the Shawn with us, we made a few hauls and caught 300 pounds weight of different sorts of fish, which were equally distributed to the ship's company. A. M. careened the ship, scrubbed, and payed the larboard side. Several of the natives visited us this morning, and brought with them some stinking fish, which, however, I ordered to be bought up to encourage them in this kind of traffic, but trade at this time seemed not to be their object, but were more inclinable to quarrel, and as the ship was upon the carrying I thought they might give us some trouble, and perhaps hurt some of our people that were in the boats alongside. For this reason I fired some small shot at one of the first offenders. This made them keep at a proper distance while they stayed, which was not long, before they all went away. These people declared to us this morning that they never either saw or heard of a ship like ours being upon this coast before. From this it appears that they have no tradition among them of Tasman being here, for I believe Murtherer's Bay, the place where he anchored, not to be far from this place.
Tasman's Massacre Bay lies 70 miles to the west-northwest.
But this cannot be it from the latitude, for I find by an observation made this day at noon, that we are at an anchor in 41 degrees 5 minutes 32 seconds south, which is 15 miles to the southward of Murtherer's Bay.
The bay in Queen Charlotte's Sound in which the Endeavour anchored, Ship Cove, lies 7 miles within the entrance on the western shore.
Wednesday, 17th. Light airs, calm and pleasant weather. P. M. righted ship and got the other side ready for heeling out, and in the evening all at the Shawn, and caught a few fish. While this was doing, some of us went in the pinnace into another cove, not far from where the ship lays. And going thither we meet with a woman floating upon the water, who to all appearance had not been dead many days. Soon after we landed we meet with two or three of the natives, who not long before must have been regaling themselves upon human flesh, for I got from one of them the bone of the forearm of a man or woman which was quite fresh, and the flesh had been but lately picked off, which they told us they had eat. They gave us to understand that, but a few days before they had taken, killed, and eat a boat's crew of their enemies or strangers, for I believe they look upon all strangers as enemies. From what we could learn, the woman we had seen floating upon the water was in this boat, and had been drowned in the fray. There was not one of us that had the least doubt but what these people were cannibals, but the finding this bone with part of the sinews fresh upon it was a stronger proof than any we had yet met with, and, in order to be fully satisfied of the truth of what they had told us, we told one of them that it was not the bone of a man, but that of a dog. But he, with great fervency, took hold of his forearm, and told us again that it was that bone. And to convince us that they had eat the flesh, he took hold of the flesh of his own arm with his teeth and made signs of eating. A. M. careened, scrubbed, and payed the starboard side of the ship. While this was doing, some of the natives came alongside seemingly only to look at us. There was a woman among them who had her arms, thighs, and legs cut in several places.
This was done by way of mourning for her husband, who had very lately been killed and eaten by some of their enemies, as they told us, and pointed towards it the place where it was done, which lay somewhere to the eastward. Mr. Banks got from one of them a bone of the forearm, much in the same state as the one before mentioned. And to show us that they eat the flesh, they bit and gnawed the bone and drawed it through their mouths, and this in such a manner as plainly showed that the flesh to them was a dainty bit. Thursday, 18th. Winds mostly from the southwest, a gentle breeze and clear settled weather. P.M. righted the ship and sent on shore all or most of our empty casks, and in the morning the co-opers went about trimming them, and the carpenters went to work to caulk the sides, and to repair other defects in the ship, while the seamen are employed in the hold cutting wood, etc., etc. I made a little excursion in the pinnace in order to take a view of the bay, accompanied by Mr. Banks and Dr. Solander. We met with nothing remarkable, and as we were on the west side of the bay, where the land is so closely covered with wood, that we could not penetrate into the country. Friday, 19th. Winds and weather as yesterday, and the employment of the people the same. In the P.M. some of our people found in the skirts of the wood three hip bones of men. They lay near to a hole or oven, that is a place where the natives dress their victuals. This circumstance, trifling as it is still a further proof that these people eat human flesh. And A.M. set up the forge, to repair the braces of the tiller, and such other iron work as was wanting. The natives came alongside, and sold us a quantity of large mackerel for nails, pieces of cloth and paper, and in this traffic they never once attempted to defraud us of any one thing, but dealt as fair as people could do. Saturday, 20th. Wind southerly and fair, pleasant weather. Employed wooding, watering, etc., and in the A.M. sent part of the powder ashore to be aired. Some of the natives brought alongside in one of their canoes four of the heads of the men they had lately killed. Both the hairy scalps and skin of the faces were on. Mr. Banks bought one of the four, but they would not part with any of the other on any account whatever. The one Mr. Banks got had received a blow on the temple that had broke the skull. This morning I set out in the pinnace accompanied by Mr. Banks and Dr. Solander, in order to survey the west coast of the bay. We took our route towards the head of the bay, but it was near noon before we had got beyond the place we had been before. Sunday, 21st. P.M. A gentle breeze of wind southerly, the remainder light airs and calm with clear, settled weather. P.M. The people employed as usual, and at 8 o'clock we returned on board the pinnace from surveying the bay, in the doing of which I met with an excellent harbor, but saw no inhabitants or any cultivated land. And A.M. after hauling the shawn for fish, I gave everybody leave to go ashore at the watering place, to amuse themselves as they thought proper. Monday, 22nd. P.M. and in the night at variable light airs and calms. A.M.M. had a fresh breeze southerly and cloudy weather. In the morning the people were set about the necessary business of the ship, and I set out in the pinnace accompanied by Mr. Banks and Dr. Solander, with a view of examining the head of the inlet. But after rowing between 4 and 5 leagues up it, and finding no probability of reaching it, or even seeing the end, the head of Queen Charlotte's Sound is 20 miles from where the Endeavour was lying. The wind being against us, and the day already half spent, we landed at noon on the southeast side in order to try to get upon one of the hills, to view the inlet from thence. Tuesday, 23rd. P.M. Wind southerly, a fresh breeze. Agreeable to what is mentioned above, I took one hand with me, and climbed up to the top of one of the hills, but when I came there I was hindered from seeing up the inlet by higher hills, which I could not come at for impenetrable woods, but I was abundantly recompensed for the trouble I had in ascending the hill, for from it I saw what I took to be the eastern sea, and a straighter passage from it into the western sea.
A little to the eastward of the entrance of the inlet in which we now lay with the ship. The mainland which lies on the southeast side of this inlet appeared to me to be a narrow ridge of very high hills, and to form a part of the southwest side of the strait, Cook's Strait,
which divides the two islands of New Zealand.
The land on the opposite side seemed to tend away east, as far as the eye could see. To the southeast appeared an open sea, and this I took to be the eastern. I likewise saw some islands lying on the east side of the inlet, which before I had taken to be a part of the mainland. As soon as I had descended the hill and we had refreshed ourselves, we set out in order to return to the ship, and in our way passed through and examined the harbors, coves, etc., that lay behind the islands above mentioned. In this route we met with an old village in which were a good many houses, but nobody had lived in them lately. We likewise saw another, that was inhabited, but the day being so far spent, that we had not time to go to it, but made the best of our way to the ship, which we reached between 8 and 9 o'clock. In the night, had much rain with cloudy, hazy weather, which continued by intervals until noon. Wednesday, 24th. P.M. Had a fresh breeze southerly and cloudy weather. After dinner I employed myself in carrying on the survey of the place, and upon one of the islands where I landed, were a number of houses but no inhabitants, neither had any been there lately. In the morning the gunner was sent ashore with the remainder of the powder today, and the longboat was sent with a gang of hands to one of the islands, to cut grass for our sheep, and the rest of the people were employed about the usual work of the ship. This forenoon some of us visited the Hippo, which is situated on the point of the island, mentioned on our first arrival, Machuara. The inhabitants of this place showed not the least dislike at our coming, but, on the contrary, with a great deal of seeming good nature showed us all over the place. We found among them some human bones, the flesh of which they told us they had eat. They likewise informed us that there was no passage into the sea through this inlet, as I had imagined there was, because above where I was in the boat it turned away to the westward. Leaving these people, we traveled to the other end of the island, and there took water and crossed over upon the main, where we met with several houses that were at present, or had very lately been, inhabited, but we saw but very few of the inhabitants, and these were in their boats fishing. After viewing this place we returned on board to dinner. Thursday, 25th. Winds at northwest, a gentle breeze and fair weather. P.M. The longboat having returned with a load of grass, she was employed bringing on board wood and water, and the caulkers having finished caulking the ship's sides,
a thing they have been employed upon ever since we came here,
they were paid with tar. Early in the A.M. the longboat was sent again for grass, and returned at noon with a load. Friday, 26th. Gentle breezes and pleasant weather. In the P.M. I made a little excursion in the pinnace along shore towards the mouth of the inlet, accompanied by Mr. Banks and Dr. Solander. We found in a small cove several of the natives, of whom we purchased a quantity of fresh fish, and upon our return to the ship found that the shawn had been equally as successful, which we generally all morning and evening, and seldom fail of getting fish sufficient for all hands. In the A.M. I made an excursion into one of the bays which lie on the east side of the inlet, accompanied by Mr. Banks and Dr. Solander. Upon our landing we ascended a very high hill, from which we had a full view of the passage I had before discovered, and the land on the opposite shore, which appeared to be about 4 leagues from us. But as it was hazy near the horizon we could not see far to the southeast. However, I had now seen enough of this passage to convince me that there was the greatest probability in the world of its running into the eastern sea, as the distance of that sea from this place cannot exceed 20 leagues even to where we were. Upon this I resolved after putting to sea to search this passage with the ship. We found on the top of the hill a parcel of loose stones, of which we built a pyramid, and left in it some musket balls, small shot, beads, and whatever we had about us that was likely to stand the test of time. After this we descended the hill, and found along with Tupia and the boat's crew several of the natives, sitting in the most free and friendly manner imaginable. Tupia always accompanies us in every excursion we make, and proves of infinite service. In our return to the ship we visited the hippo we had seen on Tuesday last, which is situated on a small island, or rather a rock. The inhabitants of this place invited us ashore with their usual marks of friendship, and shooed us all over the place, which indeed was soon done, for it was very small, yet it contained a good number of people, and they had in it, split and hanging up to dry, a prodigious quantity of various sorts of small fish, a part of which they sold to us for such trifles as we had about us. Saturday, 27th. Fresh gales, westerly. This day we got the tiller properly secured, which hath been the employment of the armorers and part of the carpenters, since we anchored at this place, the former in repairing and making new iron work, and the latter in fixing a transom. A transom is a curved piece of wood which supports the end of the tiller. For the want of which the tiller has often been in danger of being broke. The iron braces that supply it the want of a transom, have broke every time they have been repaired. Coopers still employed repairing the casks, some hands with the longboat getting on board stones, to put into the bottom of the bread room to bring the ship more by the stern, while others were employed cutting wood, repairing the rigging, and fishing. Sunday, 28th. Strong gales westerly. P. M. Fair and cloudy, the remainder thick, hazy weather, with much rain. Monday, 29th. Winds as yesterday. P. M. Rainy weather, the remainder fair and cloudy. Pretty early in the A.M. An old man, who had made us several visits upon our first arrival here, came on board, and told us that one of our boats, had furred upon and wounded two of their people, one of which was dead of his wounds. This affair happened on Sunday was a week, and never before now came to my knowledge. On that day the master and five petty officers desired, to have a small boat to go a-fishing, but instead of keeping within the usual bounds, and under the protection of the ship, they went over to the hippo on the island, from which some of the inhabitants put off in two canoes, as they thought to attack them. This caused the master to fire, and, according to the report of the old man, wounded two, one of which is instead. But this last circumstance was soon after contradicted by another of the natives, who Mr. Green and Tupia saw ashore, and I wish this last report may be true, because I find the reasons for firing upon them are not very justifiable. This morning I went out to the mouth of the inlet, and landed upon the west point, and from the top of a pretty high hill which is there I had a view of this coast to the northwest. The farthest land I could see in that quarter was an island, Stephens Island. Cape Stephens, off which it lies, forms the western termination of the strait, Cook's, between the two islands of New Zealand. The coast between this and Cape Jackson, where Cook was standing, is thickly indented with inlets of great extent. The two capes were named after the secretaries of the Admiralty.
About 10 leagues off, and lying pretty near the main, and is the same as hath been before mentioned. Between this island and the place, where I was lay some other islands close under the shore, which form several bays, where there appears to be safe anchorage for shipping. After I had set the different points, etc., we erected upon the top of the hill a tower or pile of stones, in which we left a piece of silver coin, some musket balls, beads, etc., and left flying upon it a piece of an old pendant. After this we returned to the boat, and in our way to the ship, visited some of the natives we met with along shore, and purchased of them a small quantity of fish. Tuesday, 30th. Winds at northwest, gentle breezes, and fair weather. Early in the A.M. a boat was sent to one of the islands, to get celery to boil for the people's breakfasts. While our people were gathering it near some empty huts, about 20 of the natives landed there, men, women, and children. They had no sooner got out of their canoe than 5 or 6 women sat down together and cut and sacrificed themselves, viz., their legs, shins, arms, and faces, some with shells, and others with pieces of jasper. So far as our people could understand them, this was done on account of their husbands being lately killed and devoured by their enemies. While the women was performing this ceremony, the men went about repairing the huts without showing the least concern. The carpenter went with part of his people into the woods to cut and square some timber, to saw in 2 boards for the use of the ship, and to prepare 2 posts to be set up with inscriptions on them. Wednesday, 31st. Little wind and variable. In the P.M. the carpenters, having prepared the 2 posts with inscriptions upon them, setting forth the ship's name, month, and year, one of them was set up at the watering place, on which was hoisted the Union flag. And in the morning I took the other over to the island which is known by the name of Machuaru, and is the one that lies nearest to the sea. But before I attempted to set up the post, I went first to the Hippa, having Dr. Monkhouse and Tupia along with me. We here met with the old man I have before spoke of. The first thing I did was to inquire after the man said to be killed by our people, and the one that was wounded at the same time, when it did not appear to me that any such accidents had happened. I next, by means of Tupia, explained to the old man and several others that we were come to set up a mark upon the island, in order to shoot any ship that might put into this place, that we had been here before. They not only gave their free consent to set it up, but promised never to pull it down. I then gave every one a present of one thing or another. To the old man I gave silver, 3 penny pieces dated 1763, and spike nails with the king's broad arrow cut deep in them, things that I thought were most likely to remain long among them. After I had thus prepared the way for setting up the post, we took it up to the highest part of the island, and after fixing it fast in the ground, hoisted thereon the Union flag, and I dignified this inlet with the name of Queen Charlotte's Sound, and took formal possession of it, and the adjacent lands in the name and for the use of His Majesty. We then drank Her Majesty's health in a bottle of wine, and gave the empty bottle to the old man who had attended us up the hill, with which he was highly pleased. Whilst the post was setting up, we asked the old man about the straighter passage into the Eastern Sea, and he very plainly told us there was a passage, and as I had some conjectures, that the land to the southwest of this strait which we are now at was an island, and not a continent, we questioned the old man about it, who said it consisted of 2 wanuas, that is 2 lands or islands, that might be circumnavigated in a few days, even in 4. This man spoke of 3 lands, the 2 above mentioned which he called Tovi Panamu. The 2 wanuas were doubtless the peninsulas lying west of Queen Charlotte's Sound. The 3rd was the North Island. Tiwai Panamu, the water of the greenstone, of which the most prized weapons were made, is the native name of the Middle Island. But there must have been some confusion as to the possibility of getting round this in 4 days. The name of the North Island is Tiikao Mai, the fish of Mai, but is given by Cook as Ahano Mau. It has been suggested, Rusden, that the name given to him was Tiikao Mai, the fishing of Mai, and imperfectly rendered, which signifies green talk or stone, such as they make their tools or ornaments, etc., and for the 3rd he pointed to the land on the east side of the strait. This, he said, was a large land, and that it would take up a great many moons to sail round it. This he called Ahano Mau, a name many others before had called it by. That part which borders on the strait he called Tariawit. After we had done our business upon the island, we returned on board, bringing the old man along with us, who after dinner went ashore in a canoe that came to attend upon him. February 1770. Thursday, February 1st. P. M. Having completed the ship with wood, and filled all our water, the boatswain was sent ashore with a party of men, to cut and make brooms, while others were employed about the rigging, fishing, etc. In the night and the remainder of the day, had a strong gale from the northwest, attended with very much rain. Friday, 2nd. In the P.M. the gale increased to a storm, attended with rain and squalls, which came down in excessive heavy gusts from off the high land, in one of which the hawser we had fast to the shore broke. This obliged us to let go another anchor. Towards midnight the gale moderated, and in the morning it fell calm, and we took up the sheet anchor, looked at the best bower, and moored the ship again to the shore. The heavy rain, which both fell and continues to fall, hath caused the brook we watered at to overflow its banks, and carry away 10 small casks we had standing there full of water, and notwithstanding we searched the whole cove, we could not find one of them. Saturday, 3rd. Winds northerly, mostly fair weather. Very early in the A.M. sent the longboat for celery, to boil for the ship's company's breakfast, and as I intended sailing the first opportunity, I went over to the Hippa, which is on the east side of the sound, and purchased of the inhabitants a quantity of split and half-dried fish, and such as I could get. While we were at this Hippa, Tupia made farther inquiry about the lands and strait, and these people confirmed everything the old man had before told us. About noon we took our leave of them, which some seemed not sorry for. Notwithstanding they sold us their fish very freely, there were some few among them who showed evident signs of disapprobation. Sunday, 4th. Winds northerly, a fresh breeze and fair weather. In the P.M., after returning from the Hippa, some of us made an excursion alongshore to the northward, in order to traffic with the natives for fish, in which we had no great success. In the evening, got everything off from the shore, designing to sail in the morning, but the wind not permitting, we amused ourselves in fishing, collecting of shells, etc. Monday, 5th. Winds and weather as yesterday. In the A.M. cast off the hawser, hove short on the bower, and carried out the kedge anchor, in order to warp the ship out of the cove. All the dry fish we have been able to procure from the natives, since we came here were this day divided amongst the ship's company. Tuesday, 6th. At 2 p.m. hove up the anchor, warped the ship out of the cove, and got under sail, but it soon after falling little wind, and that very variable, we anchored again a little above Maduaru. The old man, seeing us under sail, came on board to take his leave of us. Amongst other conversation that passed between him and Tupia, he was asked if either he or any of his ancestors had ever seen or heard of any ship like this being in these parts, to which question he answered in the negative, but said that his ancestors had told him that there came once to this place a small vessel from a distant part, wherein were four men that were all killed upon their landing. And being asked where this distant land lay, he pointed to the north, intimating that it would take up a great many days to go thither. Something of this L, and was mentioned by the people of the Bay of Islands, who said that some of their ancestors had been there, but it is very clear to us that their knowledge of this land is only traditionary. This was doubtless the tradition current among the Maoris, that their ancestors came from islands to the north. See note below. Had it calm all night until 6 o'clock in the morning, when a light breeze sprung up at north, and we got again under sail, but as the wind proved very unsteady, we got no farther than just without Maduaru by noon, but had a fair prospect of getting clear out of the sound, which I shall next describe. Description of Queen Charlotte's Sound. The entrance of this sound is situated in the latitude of 41 degrees south and longitude 184 degrees 45 minutes west, and near the middle of the southwest side of the strait before mentioned. The land off the southeast head of the sound called by the natives, Komaru, off which lies two small islands, and some rocks, makes the narrowest part of the strait. There stretcheth out 2 miles northeast by north from the northwest head a reef of rocks, a part of which is above water. This account of the two heads will be found sufficient guide to know this sound, which is 3 leagues broad at the entrance, and lies in southwest by south-southwest, and west-southwest at least 10 leagues, and is a collection of some of the finest harbors in the world, as will evidently appear from the plan which was taken with all the accuracy that time and circumstances would admit. The harbor or cove in which we lay, called Ship Cove, is not inferior to any in the Sound, both in point of security and other conveniences. It lies on the west side of the Sound, and is the southernmost of 3 coves lying within Matuaru, which island bears east from it. You may sail into this cove either between this last-mentioned island and the Isle Hamet, or Long Island, or between Matuaru and the west shore. In this last channel are 2 ledges of rocks 3 fathoms underwater, but they may be known by the seaweed which grows upon them. And sailing in, or out of this Sound with little wind attention, must be at to the tides, which flow 9 or 10 o'clock full, and change of the moon, and rises and falls upon a perpendicular 7 or 8 feet. The flood comes in through the strait from the southeast, and sets strong over upon the northwest head, and the reef laying off it. The ebb sets with great rapidity to the southeast over upon the islands and rocks lying off the southeast head. The variation of the compass from good observations we found to be 13 degrees 5 minutes east. The land about this Sound is of such height that we first saw it at the distance of 20 leagues. It consists wholly of high hills and deep valleys, well stored with a variety of excellent timber, fit for all purposes except ship's masts, for which use it is too hard and heavy. The sea abounds with a variety of fish, and in such plenty that, without going out of the cove where we lay, we caught daily, what with the shawn, hook, and lines, quite sufficient for all hands, and upon our first arrival we found plenty of shags, and some few other wild fowls, which to people in our situation was fresh food not to be despised. The number of inhabitants hardly exceeds 300 or 400 people. They live dispersed along the shore in search of their daily bread, which is fish and fern roots, for they cultivate no part of the lands. Upon the appearance of danger they retire to their hippas or strongholds, for in this situation we found them, and they remained so for some days after. This people are poor, when compared to many we have seen, and their canoes are mean and without ornament. The little traffic we had with them was wholly for fish, for we saw little else they had to dispose of. They had some knowledge of iron, for they very readily took nails in exchange for fish, and sometimes preferred them to anything else, which was more than the people of any other place would do. They were at first fond of paper, but when they found it spoiled by being wet they would not take it, nor did they set much value upon the cloth we got at George's Island, but shewed an extraordinary fondness for English broadcloth and red kersey, which shewed them to be a more sensible people than many of their neighbors. Besides the common dress, many of these people wore on their heads round caps made of birds' feathers, which were far from being unbecoming. Cook was not able to explore the whole of Queen Charlotte's Sound, which runs into the land for 25 miles. Towards the southern end is Picton, the port of Blenheim, the capital of the province of Marlborough. In Cook's Strait, New Zealand. Wednesday, 7th. In the P.M. had a light breeze at north by west, with which we got out of the Sound, and stood over to the eastward, in order to get the strait well open before the tide of ebb made. At 7 the 2 small islands which lies off Cape Comoru, or the southeast head of Queen Charlotte's Sound, bore east, distant 4 miles. At this time we had it nearly calm, and the tide of ebb making out, we were carried by the rapidity of the stream in a very short time close upon one of the islands, the Brothers. There is now a lighthouse on this island, where we narrowly escaped, being dashed against the rocks, by bringing the ship to an anchor in 75 fathoms water, with 150 fathoms of cable out. Even this would not have saved us had not the tide, which first set south by east, by meeting with the island, changed its direction to southeast, and carried us past the first point. When the ship was brought up, she was about 2 cables' lengths of the rocks, and in the strength of the stream, which set southeast at least 4 or 5 knots or miles per hour. A little before 12 o'clock the tide abated, and we began to heave. By 3 the anchor was at the bows, and having a light breeze at northwest, we made sail over for the eastern shore, but having the tide against us, we made but little way. The wind afterwards freshened, and came to north and northeast, with which and the tide of ebb we were in a short time hurried through the narrowest part of the strait, and then stood away for the southernmost land we had in sight, which bore from us south by west. Over this land appeared a prodigious high mountain,
the Karara Range, the summit of which is 9,500 feet high,
the summit of which was covered with snow. The narrowest part of the strait we have passed lies between Cape Komaru on Tovi Panamu and Cape Tirad on the Haino Mau, the distance from the one to the other I judged to be between 4 and 5 leagues. And notwithstanding the strength of the tides, now that is known, there is no great danger in passing it, in the doing of which I am of opinion that the northeast shore is the safest to keep upon, for upon that side there appeared no danger, whereas on the other shore there are not only the islands and rocks lying off Cape Komaru, for I discovered from the hill from which I had the second view of the strait, a reef of rocks stretching from these islands 6 or 7 miles to the southward, and lay about 2 or 3 miles off from the shore. I shall not pretend here to assign limits to the length of this strait. A view of the chart will best illustrate that. About north 9 leagues from Cape Tirad, under the same shore, is a high remarkable island that may be distinctly seen from Queen Charlotte Sound, from which it lies northeast by east 1/4 east, distant 6 or 7 leagues. I have called it Entry Isle, and was taken notice of when we first passed it on Sunday 14th of last month. On the east side of Cape Tirad the land trends away southeast by east about 8 leagues, where it ends in a point, and is the southernmost land on the Haino Mau, which I have named Cape Palliser in honor of my worthy friend Captain Palliser.
Captain Palliser, afterwards Sir Hugh, was captain of the Eagle, Cook's first ship in the Royal Navy. He discovered Cook's talents, and was his warm friend throughout his life. Between Cape Tirad and Cape Palliser is the entrance to Port Nicholson, wherein is situated Wellington, the capital of New Zealand. This entrance is, however, narrow, and Cook was never near enough to the land to discover it.
Latitude 41 degrees 34 minutes, longitude 183 degrees 58 minutes, it bore from us this day at noon south 79 degrees east, distant 12 or 13 leagues, being then in the latitude of 41 degrees 27 minutes south. At the same time Cape Komaru bore north 1/2 east, distant 7 or 8 leagues. The southernmost point of land in sight bore south 16 degrees west, and the snowy mountain southwest being about 3 leagues from the shore, and abreast of a deep bay or inlet called Cloudy Bay, in the bottom of which appeared low land covered with tall trees. Thursday, 8th. In the P.M. had a fresh breeze at north-northeast and cloudy weather. At 3 o'clock was abreast of the southernmost point of land set at noon, which I named Cape Campbell, latitude 41 degrees 42 minutes south, longitude 184 degrees 47 minutes west, it lies south by west, distant 12 or 13 leagues from Cape Komaru, and together with Cape Palliser, forms the southern entrance of the straits. The distance of the one to the other is 13 or 14 leagues west by south and east by north. From this cape we steered along shore southwest by south until 8 o'clock, when the wind died away, but an hour after a fresh breeze sprung up at southwest, and we put the ship right before it. The reason of my doing this was owing to a notion, which some of the officers had just started, that a Haino Mau was not an island, founding their opinion on the supposition that the land might extend away to the southeast from between Cape Turnagain and Cape Palliser, there being a space of about 12 or 13 leagues which we had not seen. For my own part, I had seen, so far into the sea the first time I discovered the strait, together with many other concurrent testimonies of its being an island, that no such supposition ever entered my thoughts. But being resolved to clear up every doubt that might arise on so important an object, I took the opportunity of the shifting of the wind to stand to the eastward, and accordingly steered northeast by east all night. At 9 o'clock a.m. we were abreast of Cape Palliser, where we found the land trend away northeast towards Cape Turnagain, which I reckoned to be distant from us about 26 leagues, but as the weather was hazy, so that we could not see above 4 or 5 leagues ahead, we still kept standing to the northeast, with a light breeze at south. At noon Cape Palliser bore north 72 degrees west, distant 3 leagues. Our latitude by account is 41 degrees 30 minutes south. Complete the circuit of North Island, New Zealand. Friday, 9th. Gentle breezes at south and south-southeast, hazy cloudy weather. In the p.m., 3 canoes came off to the ship, wherein were between 30 and 40 of the natives, who had been pulling after us some time. It appeared from the behavior of these people that they had heard of our being upon the coast, for they came alongside, and some of them on board the ship, without showing the least signs of fear. They were no sooner on board than they asked for nails, but when nails was given them, they asked Tupia what they were, which was plain, that they had never seen any before, yet they not only know how to ask for them, but knowed what use to make of them, and therefore must have heard of nails, which they call woe, the name of a tool among them made generally of bone, which they use as a chisel in making holes, etc. These people asking so readily for nails proves that their connections must extend as far north as Cape Kidnapper, which is 45 leagues, for that was the southernmost place on this side the coast we had any traffic with the natives. And it is most probable that the inhabitants of Queen Charlotte's Sound got the little knowledge they seemed to have of iron by the connections they may have with the Tyroidians bordering upon them. For we have no reason to think that the inhabitants of any part of this land had the least knowledge of iron before we came amongst them. After a short stay these people were dismissed with proper presents, and we continued our course along shore to the northeast until 11 o'clock a.m., when the weather cleared up, and we saw Cape Turnagain bearing north by east 14 east, distant 7 leagues. I then called the officers upon deck, and asked them if they were now satisfied that this L and was an island, to which they answered in the affirmative, and we hauled our wind to the eastward.
The Endeavour had now completely circumnavigated the North Island of New Zealand, having spent 4 months in the exploration. That Cook had communicated his enthusiasm to his officers is evident, or, knowing his determination to leave nothing doubtful, they would not have started the idea that the North Island might not be really an island. The natural wish after so many months' absence from civilization must have been to get back to it, and to take things for granted that would otherwise delay their progress.
At noon our latitude by observation was 40 degrees 55 minutes south, which is 21 miles to the southward of Cape Turnagain, it bearing north by east, and Cape Palliser by this day's run bears south 43 degrees west, 19 or 20 leagues. Saturday, 10th. Gentle breezes at southeast and cloudy weather. At 4 p.m. tacked and stood southwest until 8 a.m., when being not above 3 or 4 miles from the shore we tacked, and stood off 2 hours, and then stood again to the southwest until noon, when being in the latitude of 41 degrees 13 minutes south, and about 2 miles from the shore, the land of Cape Palliser bearing south 53 degrees west, had 26 fathoms of water. Sunday, 11th. P.M. had light breeze from the southeast. In the night it was calm until 9 a.m., when a gentle breeze sprung up at east-northeast, with which we made sail to the southward, having a large swell rolling in from that quarter. At noon was in the latitude of 41 degrees 6 minutes south, distant from the shore 112 leagues. a remarkable hillock,
Castle Point,
which stands close to the sea, bore north 1 to east, distance 4 leagues. At this time 2 canoes came alongside the ship, with whom we had some little traffic, and then dismissed them.
Monday, 12th.
Most part of P.M. had a fresh breeze at northeast, which by sunset, carried us the length of Cape Palliser, and as the weather was clear I had an opportunity of viewing the land of this cape, which is of a height sufficient to be seen in clear weather 12 or 14 leagues, and is of a broken and hilly surface. Between the foot of the high land and the sea is a border of low, flat land, off which lie some rocks that appear above water. Between this cape and Cape Turn again the land near the shore is in many places low and flat, and appeared green and pleasant, but inland are many hills. From Cape Palliser to Cape Tiraut the land is tolerable high, making in table points, and the shore forms 2 bays. At least it appeared so, for we were always too far off this part of the coast to be particular.
The northern of these was the entrance to Port Nicholson, the harbor of Auckland.
The wind continued at northeast until 12 at night, when it died away, and veered round to the west, and afterwards to south and south-southeast little wind, so that by noon we had advanced no farther than 41 degrees 52 minutes south latitude. Cape Palliser bearing north, distant 5 leagues, and the snowy mountain bore south 83 degrees west. Tuesday, 13th. P.M. light airs at southeast, the remainder calm. At noon found ourselves in the latitude of 42 degrees 2 minutes south, Cape Palliser bearing north 20 degrees east, distant 8 leagues. Wednesday, 14th. P.M. a fresh breeze sprung up at northeast, and we steered southwest by west for the southernmost land we had in sight, which bore from us at sunset south 74 degrees west. At this time we found the variation to be 15 degrees 4 minutes east. At 8 a.m. it fell calm. At this time we had run 21 leagues south 58 degrees west since yesterday at noon, which brought us abreast of the high snowy mountain, it bearing from us northwest in this direction. It lay behind a mountainous ridge of nearly the same height, which riseth directly from the sea, and runs parallel with the shore, which lies northeast 1 to north and southwest 1 to south. The northeast end of the ridge takes its rise, but a little way inland from Cape Campbell. These mountains are distinctly seen both from Cape Comeroo and Cape Palliser, being distant from the former southwest 1 to south 22 leagues, and from the latter west southwest 30 leagues. But they are of a height sufficient to be seen at a much greater distance. By some on board they are thought to be much higher than the peak of Teneriffe, which I cannot agree to, neither do I think them so high as Mount Egmont, on the southwest coast of Ahanamau, founding my opinion on the summit of the latter, being almost wholly covered with snow, whereas it only lies upon these in patches.
The highest peak of the Kakara Mountains, Mount Tapulipuka, is 9,500 feet high. It is therefore higher than Mount Egmont, but not so high as the peak of Teneriffe. The snow lies thicker on the western side of New Zealand mountains, so Cook's parallel was fallacious. The Endeavour was now near the Kakara Peninsula, where a small town stands at the present day, the shipping port of an agricultural district.
At noon was in the latitude of 42 degrees 34 minutes south. The southernmost land we had in sight bore southwest 1 to west, and some low land that made like an island lying close under the foot of the ridge northwest by north, distant about 5 or 6 leagues. Thursday, 15th. In the P.M., 4 double canoes, in which were 57 men, came off to the ship. They kept at the distance of about a stone's throw from us, and would not be prevailed upon to put alongside by all that Tupia could say to them. From this we concluded that they never had heard of our being upon the coast. At 8 p.m. a breeze sprung up at south-southwest, with which we stretched off southeast, because some on board thought they saw land in that quarter. We continued on this course until 6 a.m., at which time we had run 11 leagues, but saw no land, but that which we had left. Soon after this it fell calm, and continued so for an hour. Then a light breeze sprung up at west, which afterwards veered to the north, and we stood to the westward. At noon our latitude by observation was 42 degrees 56 minutes south, and the high land we were abreast of yesterday at noon, north-northwest 1-2 west. Friday, 16th. In the P.M. at a light breeze northeast, with which we steered west, edging in for the land, which was distant from us about 8 leagues. At 7 o'clock the southernmost extreme of the land in sight bore west-southwest, being about 6 leagues from the shore. Soon after this it fell calm, and continued so most part of the night, with sometimes light airs from the land. At daylight we discovered land bearing south by west, unseemingly detached from the coast we were upon. At 8 o'clock a breeze sprung up at north by east, and we steered directly for it. At noon was in the latitude of 43 degrees 19 minutes south. The peak on the snowy mountains bore north 20 degrees east, distant 27 leagues. The southern extremity we could see of that land bore west, and the land discovered in the morning, making like an island, extending from south-southwest to southwest by west 1-2 west, distant about 8 leagues. Our course and distance sailed since yesterday at noon southwest by west, 43 miles. Variation by this morning's amplitude 14 degrees 39 minutes east. Off Banks Peninsula, New Zealand. Saturday, 17th. P.M. stood to the southward for the land above mentioned, with the wind at north, a fresh breeze and clear weather. At 8 o'clock we had run 11 leagues since noon, when the land extended from southwest by west to north by west, being distant from the nearest shore about 3 or 4 leagues. In this situation at 50 fathoms, a fine sandy bottom. Soon after this it fell calm, and continued so until 6 a.m., when a light breeze sprung up at northwest, which afterwards veered to northeast. At sunrise, being very clear, we plainly discovered that the last mentioned L, and was an island, by seeing part of the land of Tovi Panamu open to the westward of it, extending as far as west by south. At 8 o'clock the extremes of the island bore north 76 degrees west and north northeast 1-2 east, and an opening, that had the appearance of a bay or harbor, lying near the south point north 20 degrees west, distant 3 or 4 leagues, being in 38 fathoms, a brown sandy bottom. This island, it is not an island, but a mountainous peninsula, still called after Mr. Banks, but from the lowness of the land it adjoins, looks like an island. On the north side is the fine harbor of Lyttelton, the port of Christchurch, a town of nearly 40,000 inhabitants. The harbor on the south side, that Cook saw, is Akaroa, a magnificent port, which I have named after Mr. Banks, lies about 5 leagues from the coast of Tovi Panamu. The south point bears south 21 degrees west from the higher peak on the snowy mountain so often mentioned, and lies in the latitude of 43 degrees 52 minutes south, and in the longitude of 186 degrees 30 minutes west, by observations made of the sun and moon this morning. It is of a circular figure, and may be about 24 leagues in compass. The land is of a height sufficient to be seen 12 or 15 leagues, and of a very broken uneven surface, and hath more the appearance of barrenness than fertility. Last night we saw smoke up it, and this morning some people, and therefore must be inhabited. Yesterday Lieutenant Gore, having the morning watch at the time we first saw this island, thought he saw land bearing south-southeast and southeast by east. But I, who was upon deck at the same time, was very certain that it was only clouds, which dissipated as the sun rose. But neither this, nor the running 14 leagues to the south, nor the seeing no land to the eastward of us in the evening, could satisfy Mr. Gore, but what he saw in the morning was, or might be, land. although there was hardly a possibility of its being so, because we must have been more than double the distance from it at that time to what we were either last night or this morning, at both of which times the weather was exceeding clear, and yet we could see no land either to the eastward or southward of us. Notwithstanding all this, Mr. Gore was of the same opinion this morning. Upon this I ordered the ship to be wore, and to be steered east-southeast by compass on the other tack, the point on which he said the land bore at this time from us.
Another instance of the general desire to leave nothing unexplored.
At noon we were in the latitude of 44 degrees 7 minutes south. The south point of Banks Island bore north, distant 5 leagues. Sunday, 18th. Gentle breezes at north and fair weather. P. M. stood east-southeast in search of Mr. Gore's imaginary land until 7 o'clock, at which time we had run 28 miles since noon. But seeing no land, but that we had left, or signs of any, we bore away south by west, and continued upon that course until noon, when we found ourselves in the latitude of 45 degrees 16 minutes south. Our course and distance sailed since yesterday is south 8 minutes east, 70 miles. The south point of Banks Island north 6 degrees 30 minutes west, distant 28 leagues. Variation per amplitude this morning 15 degrees 30 minutes. Seeing no signs of land, I thought it to no purpose standing any farther to the southward, and therefore hauled to the westward, thinking we were far enough to the southward to weather all the land we had left. But this opinion was only founded on the information we had had from the natives of Queen Charlotte's Sound.
The ship was still 250 miles from the south point of New Zealand.
Monday, 19th. P. M. had a moderate breeze at north-northwest and north until 8 o'clock, when it fell little wind, and was very unsettled until 10, at which time it fixed at south, and freshened it in such a manner, that before the morning it brought us under our close-reefed topsails. At 8 a.m. M. having run 28 leagues upon a west by north 1-2 north course, and now judging ourselves to be to the westward of the land of Tovi Panamu, we bore away northwest with a fresh gale at south. At 10 o'clock, having run 11 miles upon this course, we saw land extending from the southwest to the northwest at the distance of about 10 leagues from us, which we hauled up for. At noon our latitude per observation was 44 degrees 38 minutes south. The southeast point of Banks Island bore north 59 degrees 30 minutes east, distant 30 leagues, and the main body of the land in sight west by north. Course and distance sailed since yesterday at noon is north 66 degrees 45 minutes west, 96 miles. Off Tamaru, Middle Island, New Zealand. Tuesday, 20th. All P. M. had little wind, which veered round from south by east to north-northeast. Steered south-southwest, but got very little to the southward on account of a head sea. At 2 o'clock sounded in 35 fathoms, fine sandy bottom, being about 6 leagues from the land. At 7 o'clock the extremes of the land extending from southwest by south to north by west, distant from the nearest shore 6 leagues, depth of water 32 fathoms. At 12 o'clock it fell calm, and continued so until 4 a.m., when a fresh breeze sprung up at south by west, with which we stood in shore west by south, 4 leagues, our depth of water from 32 to 13 fathoms. In this last depth we tacked and stood off, being about 3 miles from the shore, which lies nearly north and south, and is here very low and flat, and continues so up to the skirts of the hills, which are at least 4 or 5 miles inland. The whole face of the country appears barren, nor did we see any signs of inhabitants.
This is a little south of Tamaru, a rising town in a fertile district. So deceptive is appearance from the sea.
Latitude at noon 44 degrees 44 minutes south. Longitude made from Banks Island to this land 2 degrees 22 minutes west. Wednesday, 21st. Wind at south. A fresh gale at 2 p.m., being in 50 fathoms, and 12 leagues from the land, we tacked and stood inshore until 8 o'clock, when we tacked and stood off until 4 a.m. then tacked and stood in, at 8 o'clock being 10 leagues from the land, at 57 fathoms. At noon, being in the latitude 44 degrees 35 minutes, and 5 or 6 leagues from the land, at 36 fathoms, notwithstanding we have carried as much sail as the ship could bear, it is apparent from the observed latitudes that we have been drove 3 leagues to leeward since yesterday. Thursday, 22nd. Moderate breezes between the southeast and south by west, and dark gloomy weather, with a swell from the southeast plying to windward, keeping between 4 and 12 leagues from the land. Depth of water from 35 to 53 fathoms, fine sandy bottom. A great many sea fowl and grampuses about the ship. And A. M. Condemned 60 fathoms of the BB cable, B.
BB stands for best power, one of the principal cables. The hempen cables of those days were a continual cause of solicitude, and required great care.
And converted it into junk. At noon had no observation, but by the land, judged ourselves to be about 3 leagues farther north than yesterday. Friday, 23rd. Wind southerly, a gentle breeze, and for the most part cloudy weather. At sunset, the weather clearing up, presented to our view a high peak mountain.
There are so many lofty mountains in this region that it is impossible to identify this. This ship was now no farther south than as he had been 5 days earlier.
Bearing northwest by north, and at the same time we saw the land more distincter than at any time we had before, extending from north to southwest by south, the inland parts of which appeared to be high and mountainous. We cannot tell yet whether or no this land joins to, or makes a part of, the land we have left. From the accounts received from the natives of Queen Charlotte's Sound it ought not, because if it did it must have been impossible for us to have sailed round it in 4 days. Besides, the mountains inland and the soundings off the coast seem to indicate this country to be more extensive than any they spoke of lying to the southward. Having a large hollow swell from the southeast, which made me expect the wind from the same quarter, we kept plying from 7 to 15 leagues from the land, depth of water 44 to 70 fathoms. At noon our latitude, by observation, was 44 degrees 40 minutes south, longitude made from Banks Island 1 degree 31 minutes west. Saturday, 24th. Calm until 6 p.m., at which time a light breeze sprung up at east-northeast, with which we steered south-southeast all night, edging off from the land, because of a hollow swell which we had from the southeast, depth of water from 60 to 75 fathoms. At daylight the wind began to freshen, and before noon blowed a fresh gale, and veered to north-northeast, at 8 a.m., saw the land extending as far as southwest by south, which we steered directly for, and at noon we were in the latitude of 45 degrees 22 minutes south. The land in sight extending from southwest 1 to south to north-northwest making high and hilly. Course and distance run since yesterday at noon is south 15 degrees west, 47 miles. In the P.M., while we lay becalmed, Mr. Banks, in a small boat, shot 2 Port Egmont hens, which were in every respect the same sort of birds as are found in great numbers upon the island of Faro. They are of a very dark brown plumage, with a little white about the underside of their wings, and are as large as a Muscovy duck. These were the first that we have seen since we arrived upon the coast of this country, but we saw of them for some days before we made land. Off Otago, Middle Island, New Zealand. Sunday, 25th. In the P.M. steered southwest by south and southwest, edging in for the land, having the advantage of a fresh gale at north, which I was over desirous of making the most of, and by that means carried away the main top gallant mast and fore top mast steering sail boom, but these were soon replaced by others. Although we kept at no great distance from the shore, yet the weather was so hazy that we could see nothing distinct upon the land, only that there were a ridge of pretty high hills lying parallel with, and but a little way from the sea coast, which lies south by west and north by east, and seemed to end in a high bluff point to the southward, which we run the length of by 8 o'clock, when, being dark, and not knowing which way the land trended, we brought to for the night, having run 15 leagues upon a southwest 1-2 west course since noon. The point bore at this time west, distant about 5 miles, depth of water 37 fathoms, the bottom small pebble stones. At 4 a.m. we made sail, but by this time the northerly wind was gone, and was succeeded by one from the southward, which proved very variable and unsteady. At daylight the point above mentioned bore north, distant 3 leagues, and we found that the land trended away from it southwest by west, as far as we could see. This point of land I have named Cape Saunders, in honor of Sir Charles.
Admiral Sir Charles Saunders was first Lord of the Admiralty in 1766. He commanded the fleet at the capture of Quebec in 1759, in which Cook served. Latitude 45 degrees 55 minutes south. Longitude 189 degrees 4 minutes west.
It requires no description to know it by the latitude and the angle made here by the coast, will be found quite sufficient. However, there is a remarkable saddle hill laying near the shore, 3 or 4 leagues southwest of the cape. From 1 to 4 leagues north of the cape the shore seemed to form 2 or 3 bays, wherein there appeared to be anchorage and shelter from southwest, westerly, and northwest winds.
One of these is Otago Harbor, where lies Dunedin, perhaps the most important commercial city in New Zealand.
I had some thoughts of bearing up for one of these places in the morning, when the wind came to southwest, but the fear of losing time, and the desire I had of pushing to the southward, in order to see as much of the coast as possible, or, if this land should prove to be an island, to get round it, prevented me. Being not far from the shore all this morning, we had an opportunity of viewing the land pretty distinctly. It is of a moderate height, full of hills, which appeared green and woody, but we saw not the least signs of inhabitants. At noon Cape Saunders bore north 30 degrees west, distant 4 leagues. Latitude per log, for we had no observation, 46 degrees 0 minutes south. Monday, 26th. In the p.m. at the wind wifeling all round the compass, sometimes blowing a fresh gale, and at other times almost calm. At 5 o'clock it fixed at west-southwest, and soon blew it so hard, as to put us past our topsails, and to split the foresail all to pieces. After getting another to the yard, we continued standing to the southward under 2 courses. At 1 a.m. the wind moderating, set the topsails with 1 reef out. But soon after daylight the gale increased to a storm, with heavy squalls, attended with rain. This brought us again under our courses, and the main topsail being split we unbended and bent another. At 6 o'clock the southernmost land in sight bore west by north, and Cape Saunders bore north by west, distant 8 leagues. At noon it bore north 20 minutes west, distant 14 leagues. Latitude observed 46 degrees 35 minutes. Tuesday, 27th. A very hard gale at southwest by west, and west-southwest, with heavy squalls attended with showers of rain, and a large hollow sea, without the least intermission the whole of this 24 hours. We continued under our courses from noon until 7 p.m., when we handed the mainsail, and lay to under the foresail with the head to the southward. Latitude at noon 46 degrees 54 minutes. Longitude made from Cape Saunders 1 degree 24 minutes east. Wednesday, 28th. Strong gale at southwest, with a large sea from the same quarter. At 7 p.m. made sail under the courses. At 8 a.m. set the topsails close reefed. At noon, being in the latitude of 47 degrees 43 minutes south, and longitude east from Cape Saunders 2 degrees 10 minutes, wore and stood to the northward. March 1770. Thursday, March 1st. Winds between the southwest and north-northwest, a fresh gale. In the p.m. found the variation, to be 16 degrees 34 minutes east. At 8 tacked and stood to the southward, with the wind at west, which before the morning veered to northwest, accompanied with hazy weather and drizzling rain. At daylight loosed a reef out of each topsail, and set some of the small sails. At noon our latitude by account was 47 degrees 52 minutes south, and longitude made from Cape Saunders 1 degree 8 minutes east. Friday, 2nd. Strong gales from the west, with heavy squalls, attended with showers of rain. And the P.M. stood to the southward till half past 3, when being in the latitude 48 degrees 0 minutes south and longitude 188 degrees 00 minutes west, and seeing no visible signs of land, we tacked and stood to the northward, having a very large swell from the southwest by west. Soon after we tacked we close reefed the topsails, and in the night were obliged to hand them, but at daylight set them again. At noon our latitude by observation was 46 degrees 42 minutes south, Cape Saunders bearing north 46 degrees west, distant 68 miles. Saturday, 3rd. P.M. wind and weather as yesterday. A.M. quite moderate, yet the southwest swell continues, which makes me conjecture that there is no land near in that quarter. At noon our latitude was 46 degrees 42 minutes south, being east of Cape Saunders 1 degree 30 minutes. Sunday, 4th. At 4 p.m. the wind coming to the northward we stood to the westward with all the sail we could make. In the morning, got up top gallant yards, and set the sails, found the variation to be 16 degrees 16 minutes east. Saw several whales, seals, and one penguin. This bird was but small of the sort, but seemed to be such a one as we had never seen before. We have seen several seals since we passed the straits, but never saw one upon the whole coast of Ahanamau. We sounded both in the night and the morning, but found no bottom with 150 fathoms line. At noon we saw Cape Saunders bearing north 12 west. Our latitude by observation was 46 degrees 31 minutes south.
The Endeavour had been blown off the land for 7 days, and had barely recovered her position.
Off south part of Middle Island, New Zealand. Right bracket, Monday, 5th. Most part of P.M. had a fresh breeze at north by east. Half past 1 saw land bearing west by south, which we steered for. Before dark we were within 3 or 4 leagues of it, and seeing no land farther to the south we were in hopes this would prove the southern point. At 7 shortened sail, and kept under an easy sail all night, standing to the west-southwest, having the wind at northwest, and north-northwest until 2 a.m., when it fell calm, and soon after a breeze sprung up at southeast by south, and daylight coming on we made sail. During the whole night we saw a large fire upon the land, a certain sign of its being inhabited. At 7 the extremes of the land, bore from north 38 degrees east to west 6 minutes south, being distant from the shore about 3 leagues. The land appeared of a moderate height, and not hilly. At 12 past 10 o'clock the westernmost land in sight bore west 12 north, distant 7 leagues. At noon at fresh gales at south-southeast, and thick hazy weather with rain. Our latitude by account was 46 degrees 50 minutes south, and longitude made from Cape Saunders 1 degree 56 minutes west.
The ship was now off the south point of the Middle Island.
Tuesday, 6th. P.M. winds at south by east and southeast, and thick hazy weather until 3 o'clock, when it cleared up, and we saw the land extending from northeast by north to northwest 12 north, and soon after low land, making like an island, bearing west 12 south. Keeping on our course to the west by south, we in 2 hours' time saw high land over the low, extending to the southward as far as southwest by south. We could not see this land joined to that to the northward of us, there either being a total separation, a deep bay, or low land between them. At 8 o'clock, being within 3 leagues of the low land,
which we now took to be an island, Ruapuk Island,
we tacked and stood to the eastward, having the wind at south, which proved very unsettled all night, by which means, and a little bad management, I found the ship in the morning considerably farther to the eastward than I expected, and the wind afterwards coming to southwest and west-southwest, so that at noon we found ourselves much about the same place as we were yesterday, our latitude by observation being 46 degrees 50 minutes south, the land extending from northeast by east to west by north 1-2 north, the nearest part bearing north, distance 3 leagues, the land to the southwest just in sight. Wednesday, 7th. Light airs in the southwest quarter. P.M. clear weather, remainder dark and cloudy. And the P.M. found the variation per several azimuths, and the amplitude to be 15 degrees 10 minutes east, and by the amplitude in the morning, to be 15 degrees 56 minutes east. Stood to the southeast until 8 a.m., then tacked and stood to the northwest, but it soon after fell calm, and continued so until noon, when by our account we were in the latitude of 47 degrees 6 minutes south, and had made 12 miles easting since yesterday at noon. Thursday, 8th. Light airs next to a calm from south-southeast to northeast, with which we kept steering to the southwest, but made but little way, because of a swell which took us right ahead. At daylight a.m. we saw, or thought we saw, from the masthead, the land which we have left to the northward of us joined to that to the southwest of us, and at the same time we imagined we saw the land extend to the southward as far as south-southwest. But after steering this course until noon we discovered our mistake, for there was no land to be seen to the southward of west, which course we now steered, being by observation in the latitude of 47 degrees 12 minutes, longitude made from Cape Saunders 2 degrees 2 minutes west, off South Cape of New Zealand. Right bracket, Friday, 9th. P.M. winds at north, a gentle breeze and clear weather. Stood to the westward until sunset, at which time the extremes of the land bore from north by east to west, distant about 7 or 8 leagues, depth of water 55 fathoms, variation by the amplitude 16 degrees 29 minutes east. The wind now veered to the westward, and as the weather was fine, and moonlight we kept standing close upon a wind to the southwest all night. At 4 a.m. sounded, and at 60 fathoms, at daylight we discovered under our lee bow ledges of rocks, on which the sea broke very high, extending from south by west to west by south, and not above 3/4 of a mile from us. Yet upon sounding we had 45 fathoms, a rocky bottom. The wind being at northwest we could not weather the ledge, and as I did not care to run to leeward, we tacked and made a trip to the eastward. But the wind soon after coming to the north, enabled us to go clear of all. Our soundings in passing within the ledge was from 35 to 47 fathoms, a rocky bottom. This ledge lies southeast, 6 leagues from the southernmost part of the land, and southeast by south from some remarkable hills which stand near the shore. These rocks are not the only dangers that lay here, for about 3 leagues to the northward of them is another ledge of rocks, laying full 3 leagues from the land, whereon the sea broke very high. As we passed these rocks in the night at no great distance, and discovered the others close under our lee at daylight, it is apparent that we had a very fortunate escape. I have named them the traps, because they lay as such to catch unwary strangers.
The dangerous traps lie south and east of the South Island of New Zealand. The Endeavour had now at last got to the southward of the land. There is a small but high rock farther south, the Snares, that Cook did not sight this voyage.
At noon our latitude per observation was 47 degrees 26 minutes south. Longitude made from Cape Saunders 3 degrees 4 minutes west, the land in sight, which has very much the appearance of an island,
South or Stewart Island,
comma extending northeast by north to northwest by west, distant from the shore about 4 or 5 leagues, the easternmost ledge of rocks bore south-southeast, distant 1-1-2 leagues, and northernmost northeast 1-2 east, 3 leagues. This land is of a moderate height, and has a very barren aspect, Not a tree to be seen upon it, only a few small shrubs. There were several white patches, on which the sun's rays reflected very strongly, which I take to be a kind of marble such as we have seen in many places of this country, particularly to the northward. Saturday, 10th. P.M. Moderate breezes at northwest by north and north with which we stood close upon a wind to the westward. At sunset the southernmost point of land, which I afterwards named South Cape.
South Cape is the southern point of Stewart Island. Cook's position for it is wonderfully exact.
And which lies in the latitude of 47 degrees 19 minutes south, longitude 192 degrees 12 minutes west from Greenwich, bore north 38 degrees east, distant 4 leagues, and the westernmost land in sight bore north 2 degrees east. This last was a small island, lying off the point of the main.
Long Island, which lies, with others, on the west side of Stewart Island.
I began now to think that this was the southernmost land, and that we should be able to get round it by the west, for we have had a large hollow swell from the southwest ever since we had the last gale of wind from that quarter, which makes one think there is no land in that direction. In the night it began to blow, so that at or before daylight we were brought under our two courses. But at 8 a.m. it fell moderate, and we set the topsails close-reefed, and the mizzen and mizzen staysail being split, we unbent them and bent others. At noon, the wind coming at west, we tacked and stood to the northward, having no land in sight. Our latitude by observation was 47 degrees 33 minutes south, longitude west from the South Cape 0 degrees 59 minutes. Sunday, 11th. Winds between the west and northwest, a fresh gale, and clear weather. Stood away north-northeast close upon a wind without seeing any land until 2 a.m., when we discovered an island bearing northwest by north, distant 4 or 5 leagues. 2 hours after this, we saw the land ahead, upon which we tacked and stood off until 6 o'clock, then stood in order to take a nearer view of it. At 11, being about 3 leagues from the land, and the wind seemed to incline on shore, we tacked and stood off to the southward. And now we thought that the land to the southward, or that we have been sailing round these 2 days past, was an island, because there appeared an open channel between the north part of that land, and the south part of the other, in which we thought we saw the small island we were in with the 6th instant. But when I came to lay this land down upon paper from the several bearings I had taken, it appeared that there was but little reason to suppose it an island. On the contrary, I hardly have a doubt but what it joins to, and makes a part of, the mainland.
Cook was deceived, as Stewart is an island,
the western extremity of which bore at noon north 59 degrees west, and the island seen in the morning.
This was called by Cook Solander Island.
South 59 degrees west, distant 5 leagues. Latitude observed 46 degrees 24 minutes south, longitude 192 degrees 49 minutes west. It is nothing but a barren rock of about a mile in circuit, remarkably high, and lies full 5 leagues from the main. The shore of the main lies nearest east by south and west by north, and forms a large open bay, in which there is no appearance of a harbor, or other place of safety for shipping against southwest and southerly winds. The face of the country bears a very rugged aspect, being full of high craggy hills, on the summits of which were several patches of snow. However, the land is not wholly barren. We could see wood, not only in the valleys, but on several of the hills, but we saw no signs of inhabitants. Monday, 12th. Fresh gales between the west and northwest, latter part squally, with rain. Stood to the southwest by south until 11 a.m., at which time the wind shifted to the southwest by west. We wore, and stood to the north-northwest, being then in the latitude of 47 degrees 40 minutes south, and longitude 193 degrees 50 minutes west, having a hollow sea from the southwest. Tuesday, 13th. Strong gale between the southwest by west and south-southwest, with a large hollow sea from the same quarter. in the PMM at frequent squalls, with showers of rain, in the night at several very heavy squalls, attended with showers of hail, which obliged us to take in our topsails. During the night steered north-northwest until 6 a.m., when, seeing no land, we steered north by east, and set the main topsail, single reefed. At 8 set the fore topsail, single reefed, and loosed all the reefs out of the main topsail, and steered northeast by east 1-2 east in order to make the land. At 10 saw it bearing east-northeast, and appeared to be very high, but, being hazy over it, we could see nothing distinct neither now nor at noon, when, by observation, we were in the latitude of 46 degrees 0 minutes south. Course and distance sailed since yesterday north 5 degrees west, 96 miles. Longitude made from the South Cape 1 degree 40 minutes west. Off the New Zealand Sounds. Right bracket, Wednesday, 14th. In the P.M. at a fresh gale from the southward, attended with squalls. At 2 it cleared up over the land, which appeared high and mountainous. At 1-2 past 3 double reefed the topsails, and hauled in for a bay, wherein there appeared to be good anchorage, and into which I had thought of going with the ship. But after standing in an hour, we found the distance too great to run before dark, and it blowed too hard to attempt it in the night, or even to keep to windward. For these reasons we gave it up, and bore away longshore. This bay I have named Dusky Bay. It lies in the latitude of 45 degrees 47 minutes south. It is about 3 or 4 miles broad at the entrance, and seems to be full as deep. In it are several islands, behind which there must be shelter from all winds, provided there is a sufficient depth of water.
Dusky Bay is one of the remarkable inlets known now as the New Zealand Sounds. They are very deep, narrow fiords, running into the high mountains, that here come close to the shore, and are much visited now for the sake of the grandeur of the scenery. Cook visited and surveyed Dusky Bay in his next voyage. The Endeavour had nearly as much tempestuous weather in rounding the south end of New Zealand as he had off the North Cape, but Cook managed to get a very fair idea of the coast, notwithstanding, by dint of perseverance.
The north point of this bay, when it bears southeast by south, is very remarkable, there being off it 5 high-peaked rocks, standing up like the forefingers and thumb of a man's hand, on which account I have named it Point Five Fingers. The land of this point is farther remarkable by being the only level land near it, and extends near 2 leagues to the northward. It is pretty high, wholly covered with wood, and hath very much the appearance of an island, by its aspect, being so very different from the land behind it, which is nothing but barren rocky mountains. At sunset the southernmost land in sight bore due south, distant 5 or 6 leagues, and as this is the westernmost point of land upon the whole coast I have called it West Cape. It lies about 3 leagues to the southward of the bay above mentioned, in the latitude of 45 degrees 54 minutes south, and longitude 193 degrees 17 minutes west. The land of this cape seems to be of a moderate height next the sea, and hath nothing remarkable about it that we could see, except a very white cliff 2 or 3 leagues to the southward of it. The land to the southward of Cape West trends away towards the southeast. To the northward of it, it trends north-northeast and northeast. At 7 o'clock brought the ship to under the foresail, with her head offshore, having a fresh gale at south by east. At midnight it moderated, and we wore and lay her head inshore until 4 a.m., then made sail, and steered alongshore northeast 1-2 north, having a moderate breeze at south-southeast. At noon we were by observation in the latitude 45 degrees 13 minutes south. Course and distance sailed since yesterday north 41 degrees east, 62 miles. Longitude made from Cape West 0 degrees 29 minutes east, being at this time about 112 leagues from shore. Sounded, and had no ground with 70 fathoms line. A little before noon we passed a little narrow opening in the land, where there appeared to be a very snug harbor,
doubtful sound, another of the fires mentioned in note above.
Formed by an island in the latitude of 45 degrees 16 minutes south. Inland, behind this opening, were mountains, the summits of which were covered with snow that seemed to have fallen lately, and this is not to be wondered at, for we have found it very cold for these 2 days past. The land on each side the entrance of this harbor riseth almost perpendicular from the sea to a very considerable height, and this was the reason why I did not attempt to go in with the ship, because I saw clearly that no winds could blow there, but what was right in or right out, that is, westerly or easterly, and it certainly would have been highly imprudent in me to have put into a place where we could not have got out but with a wind that we have lately found to blow but 1 day in a month. I mention this because there was some on board that wanted me to harbor at any rate, without in the least considering either the present or future consequences. Thursday, 15th. Clear weather, winds at southwest and southwest by south, a gentle breeze, except in the night, when we had variable light airs and calm. In the evening, being about 2 leagues from the land, we sounded, but had no ground with 103 fathoms. Variation per azimuth 14 degrees east, per amplitude 15 degrees 2 minutes east. With what wind we had, we made the best of our way longshore to the northeast, keeping at the distance of 2 or 3 leagues off from the land. At noon we were in the latitude of 44 degrees 47 minutes, having run only 12 leagues upon the northeast 1/4 north course since yesterday at noon. Longitude made from Cape West 1 degree 3 minutes east. Friday, 16th. Winds at southwest, a fresh breeze and clear. Steered alongshore northeast 1/4 east until 6 p.m., when we shortened sail, and brought to for the night. Variation per azimuth 13 degrees 48 minutes east. At 4 a.m. made sail, and stood in for the land. At daylight saw the appearance of an inlet into the land, but upon a nearer approach found that it was only a deep valley, bounded on each side by high lands, upon which we bore away northeast 1/4 east along shore, keeping about 4 or 5 miles off. At noon the northernmost point of land in sight bore north 60 degrees east, distant 10 miles, latitude per observation 44 degrees 5 minutes, longitude made from Cape West 2 degrees 8 minutes east. Saturday, 17th. Continued our course along shore, having in the P.M. the advantage of a fresh gale at southwest. At 2, passed by the point aforementioned, which is of a moderate height, with deep red cliffs, down which falls 4 small streams of water, on which account it is named Cascades Point. Latitude 44 degrees 0 minutes south, longitude 2 degrees 20 minutes east from Cape West. From this point the land at first trends north 76 degrees east, but afterwards more to the northward east northeast, 8 leagues. From this point, and near the shore, lies a small low island, which bore from us south by east, distant 112 leagues. At 7 o'clock we shortened sail, and brought to under the topsails, with her head off shore, having 33 fathoms, and fine sandy bottom. At 10, at 50 fathoms, and at 12, wore in 65 fathoms, having drove about 5 miles north-northwest, since we brought to. 2 hours after this had no ground with 140 fathoms, which shows that the soundings extend but a little way from the land. From 2 to 8 a.m. had it calm and hazy, with drizzling rain, at which time a breeze sprung up at southwest, with which we steered along shore northeast by east 1/4 east, keeping about 3 leagues from the land. At noon had no observation, being hazy with rain. Our run since yesterday at noon is northeast by east, 55 miles, longitude from Cape West 3 degrees 12 minutes east. Off west coast of Middle Island, New Zealand. Sunday, 18th. In the P.M. had a fresh breeze at southwest by west, attended with drizzling rain. At 8, being about 3 leagues from the land, shortened sail, and brought to, having run 10 leagues northeast by east since noon, at this time at 44 fathoms, and 2 hours before at 17 fathoms, fine sandy bottom, being then about 1 league from the land. Had it calm the most part of the night, and until 10 a.m., when a light breeze sprung up at southwest by west. We made sail along shore northeast by north, having a large swell from the west-southwest, which had risen in the night. At noon latitude, in per observation 43 degrees 4 minutes south, course and distance sailed since yesterday is north 54 degrees east, 54 miles, longitude made from Cape West 4 degrees 12 minutes east. The mountains and some of the valleys we observed this morning were wholly covered with snow, part of which we supposed to have fallen in the p.m. and for part of the night, at the time that we had rain, and yet the weather is not cold.
They did not see Mount Cook, 12,300 feet high, and the highest mountain in New Zealand. No doubt the summit was in the clouds.
Monday, 19th. In the p.m. had a fresh breeze at southwest by west and west-southwest, which we made the most of until 6, when we shortened sail, and at 10 brought to, and sounded 115 fathoms, judging ourselves to be about 5 leagues from the land. At midnight it fell little wind, on which account we made sail. At 8 a.m. the wind veered to the northwest by north, with which we stood to the northeast close upon a wind until noon, at which time we tacked, being about 3 leagues from the land, and by observation in the latitude of 42 degrees 8 minutes and longitude from Cape West 5 degrees 5 minutes east.
The Endeavour had passed the mouth of the Grey River, the district of the great coalfields of New Zealand.
Course and distance run since yesterday at noon north 35 degrees east, 68 miles. Depth of water 65 fathoms, the land extending from northeast by north to south-southwest. Tuesday, 20th. Fresh gales at northwest by north and north by west. P.M. Fair weather, the remainder hazy, with rain and squall, which brought us under close reefed topsails. Stood to the westward until 2 a.m., when we made a trip to the eastward, and afterwards stood to the westward until noon, when, by our reckoning, we were in the latitude of 42 degrees 23 minutes south. Course and distance sailed south 74 degrees west, 54 miles, longitude made from Cape West 5 degrees 55 minutes east. Tacked and stood to the eastward. Wednesday, 21st. In the p.m. had a fresh gale at north by west, attended with rain until 6, when the wind shifted to south and south-southwest, and continued to blow a fresh gale, with which we steered northeast by north until 6 a.m., at which time we hauled in east by north in order to make the land which we saw soon after. At noon our latitude per account was 41 degrees 37 minutes, and longitude from Cape West 5 degrees 42 minutes east. Course and distance sailed since yesterday north 60 degrees east, 92 miles. At this time we were not above 3 or 4 leagues from the land, but being very foggy upon it, we could see nothing distinct, and as we had not much wind, and a prodigious swell rolling in upon the shore from the west-southwest, I did not think it safe to go near. Thursday, 22nd. In the p.m. had a gentle breeze from the south-southwest, with which we steered along shore northeast until 8, when being about 2 or 3 leagues from shore we sounded, and at 34 fathoms, upon which we hauled off northwest by north until 11, then brought to, having at this time 64 fathoms. At 4 a.m. made sail to the northeast, wind at south-southwest, a light breeze. At 8 the wind veered to the westward, and soon after fell calm. At this time we were about 3 or 4 miles from the shore, and in 54 fathoms, having a large swell from the west-southwest rolling obliquely upon the shore, which put me under a good deal of apprehension, that we should be obliged to anchor. But by the help of a light air now, and then from the southwest quarter we were enabled to keep the ship from driving much nearer the shore. At noon the northernmost land in sight bore northeast by east 14 east, distant 8 or 10 leagues. Our latitude by account was 40 degrees 55 minutes south, Longitude from Cape West 6 degrees 35 minutes east. Course and distance sailed since yesterday at noon north 36 degrees east, 42 miles. Very foggy over the land. Off Cape Farewell, Middle Island, New Zealand. Right bracket, Friday, 23rd. Light airs from the southward, at intervals calm, the forepart hazy, the remainder clear, pleasant weather. At noon our latitude, by observation, 40 degrees 36 minutes 30 seconds south, longitude from Cape West 6 degrees 52 minutes east. The easternmost point of land in sight, Cape Farewell, the north point of the Middle Island. Bore east 10 degrees north, distant 7 leagues, and a bluff header point we were abreast of yesterday at noon, off which lay some rocks above water, bore south 18 degrees west, distant 6 leagues. This point I have named Rocks Point, latitude 40 degrees 55 minutes south. Having now nearly run down the whole of this northwest coast of Tovey Panamu, it is time I should describe the face of the country as it hath at different times appeared to us. I have mentioned on the 11th instant, at which time we were off the southern part of the island, that the land seen then was rugged and mountainous, and there is great reason to believe that the same ridge of mountains extends nearly the whole length of the island from between the westernmost land seen that day, and the easternmost seen on the 13th. There is a space of about 6 or 8 leagues of the sea coast unexplored, but the mountains inland were visible enough. The land near the shore about Cape West is rather low, and riseth with a gradual ascent up to the foot of the mountains, and appeared to be mostly covered with wood. From 0.5 fingers down to the latitude of 44 degrees 20 minutes there is a narrow ridge of hills rising directly from the sea, which are clothed with wood. Close behind these hills lies the ridge of mountains, which are of a prodigious height, and appear to consist of nothing but barren rocks, covered in many places with large patches of snow, which perhaps have lain there since the creation. No country upon earth can appear with a more rugged and barren aspect than this doth. From the sea for as far inland as the eye can reach nothing is to be seen, but the summits of these rocky mountains, which seem to lay so near one another as not to admit any valleys between them. From the latitude of 44 degrees 20 minutes to the latitude 42 degrees 8 minutes these mountains lay farther inland. The country between them and the sea consists of woody hills and valleys of various extent, both for height and depth, and hath much the appearance of fertility. Many of the valleys are large, low, and flat, and appear to be wholly covered with wood. But it is very probable that great part of the land is taken up in lakes, ponds, etc., as is very common in such like places. From the last mentioned latitude to Cape Farewell, afterwards so called, the land is not distinguished by anything remarkable. It rises in two hills directly from the sea, and is covered with wood. While we were upon this part of the coast the weather was foggy, insomuch that we could see but a very little way inland. However, we sometimes saw the summits of the mountains above the fog and clouds, which plainly showed that the inland parts were high and mountainous, and gave me great reason to think that there is a continued chain of mountains from the one end of the island to the other. This is, to a great extent, the case. Saturday, 24th. In the P.M. had a gentle breeze at southwest, which by dark, run us the length of the eastern point set at noon, and not knowing what course the land took on the other side, we brought to in 34 fathoms about 1 league from the land. At 8, it falling little wind, we filled and stood on until 12, at which time we brought to until 4 a.m., then made sail. At daylight we saw low land extending from the above point to the east-southeast as far as the eye could reach, the eastern extremity of which appeared in round hillocks. By this time the wind had veered to the eastward, which obliged us to ply to windward. At noon the point above mentioned bore southwest by south, distant 16 miles, latitude observed 40 degrees 19 minutes south. This point I afterwards named Cape Farewell, for reasons which will be given in their proper place. Sunday, 25th. Winds easterly. Towards noon had little winds and hazy, with rain. Made several trips, but gained nothing to windward, so that at noon our situation was nearly as yesterday. Monday, 26th. At 3 p.m. the wind came to north, and we steered east-southeast with all the sail we could set until dark, when we shortened sail until the morning, having thick misty weather. All night we keep the lead going continually, and at from 37 to 48 fathoms. At daylight we saw the land bearing southeast by east, and an island laying near it bearing east-southeast, distant 5 leagues. This I knew to be the island, Stephen's Island. Seen from the entrance of Queen Charlotte's Sound, from which it bears northwest by north, distant 9 leagues. At noon it bore southeast, distant 4 or 5 miles, and the northwest head of Queen Charlotte's Sound bore southeast by south, distant 10 12 leagues. Latitude observed 43 degrees 33 minutes south. In Admiralty Bay, Middle Island, New Zealand. ... Tuesday, 27th. Fresh breeze of wind westerly, and hazy, misty weather, with drizzling rain. As we have now circumnavigated the whole of this country, it is time for me to think of quitting it. But before I do this, it will be necessary to complete our water first, especially as we have on board above 30 tons of casks empty, and knowing that there is a bay between the above-mentioned island and Queen Charlotte's Sound, wherein no doubt there is anchorage and convenient watering places. Accordingly, in the P.M.M. we hauled round the island and into the bay,
Admiralty Bay, leaving
3 more islands,
Rangitoto Islets.
On our starboard hand, which lay close under the west shore 3 or 4 miles within the entrance. As we run in we keep the lead going, and at from 40 to 12 fathoms. At 6 we anchored in 11 fathoms, muddy bottom, under the west shore, in the second cove within the forementioned island. At daylight I took a boat, and went to look for a watering place, and a proper berth to moor the ship in, both of which I found convenient enough. After the ship was moored I sent an officer ashore to superintend the watering, and the carpenter with his crew to cut wood, while the longboat was employed carrying on shore empty casks. Wednesday, 28th. Winds westerly, which in the A.M. blowed a fresh gale, attended with rain. Employed getting on board wood and water and fishing. In the latter we were pretty successful. Thursday, 29th. In the P.M. had a strong gale from the westward. A.M. variable light airs from the eastward, and hazy rainy weather the whole day, which, however, did not prevent us getting on board wood and water. Friday, 30th. Winds at southeast, a moderate breeze, the first and middle part dark, hazy weather, with rain, the latter, fair. In the A.M., as the wind seemed to be settled at southeast, and having nearly completed our water, we warped the ship out of the cove in order to have room to get under sail. Before this was done it was noon, at which time I went away in the pinnace, in order to examine the bay, and to explore as much of it as the little time I had would admit. Saturday, 31st. In the P.M., after rowing a league and a half, or 2 leagues up the bay, I landed upon a point of land on the west side, where, from an eminency, I could see this western arm of the bay run in southwest by west, about 5 leagues farther, yet did not see the head of it. There appeared to be several other inlets, or at least small bays, between this and the northwest head of Queen Charlotte's Sound, in every one of which I make no doubt, but what there is anchorage and shelter for shipping, as they are partly covered from the sea wind by these islands, that lay without them.
There is a maze of inlets, and harbors between Admiralty Bay and Queen Charlotte's Sound, a distance of 20 miles.
The land about this bay, at least what I could see of it, is of a very hilly uneven surface, and appears to be mostly covered with wood, shrubs, ferns, etc., which renders traveling both difficult and fatiguing. I saw no inhabitants, neither have we seen any, since we have been in this bay, but met with several of their huts, all of which appeared to have been at least 12 months deserted. Upon my return to the ship, in the evening, I found the water, etc., all on board, and the ship ready for sea, and being now resolved to quit this country altogether, and to bend my thought towards returning home by such a route as might conduce most to the advantage of the service I am upon, I consulted with the officers upon the most eligible way of putting this in execution. To return by the way of Cape Horn was what I most wished, because by this route we should have been able to prove the existence or non-existence of a southern continent, which yet remains doubtful. But in order to ascertain this, we must have kept in a higher latitude in the very depth of winter, but the condition of the ship, in every respect, was not thought sufficient for such an undertaking. For the same reason the thoughts of proceeding directly to the Cape of Good Hope was laid aside, especially as no discovery of any moment could be hoped for in that route. It was therefore resolved to return by way of the East Indies by the following route. Upon leaving this coast to steer to the westward until we fall in with the east coast of New Holland, and then to follow the direction of that coast to the northward, or what other direction it might take us, until we arrive at its northern extremity, and if this should be found impracticable, then to endeavor to fall in with the land or islands discovered by Quiros.
Quiros, a Spanish navigator, discovered in 1605 Espiritu Santo, the northern island of the New Hebrides, which he supposed to be a part of a great southern continent. Cook, in his second voyage, thoroughly explored the New Hebrides group, and for some of the islands his charts are still the only guide.
With this view, at daylight we got under sail and put to sea, having the advantage of a fresh gale at southeast and clear weather. At noon the island, which lies off the northwest point of the bay, bore east 9 degrees south, distant 10 miles. Our latitude, by observation, was 40 degrees 35 minutes south. This bay I have named Admiralty Bay, the northwest point Cape Stevens, and the east point Jackson, after the two secretaries.
The two secretaries of the Admiralty, Philip Stevens and George Jackson, both of whom showed great appreciation of Cook.
It may always be known by the island above mentioned, which is pretty high, and lies northeast, 2 miles from Cape Stevens, latitude 40 degrees 37 minutes south, longitude 185 degrees 6 minutes west. Between this island and Cape Farewell, which is west by north and east by south, distant 14 or 15 leagues from each other, the shore forms a large deep bay, the bottom of which we could hardly see in sailing in a straight line from the one cape to the other. But it is not at all improbable, but what it is all lowland next the sea, as we have met with less water here than on any other part of the coast at the same distance from land. However, a bay there is, and is known on the chart by the name of Blind Bay, but I have reason to believe it to be Tasman's Murderer's Bay.
Blind Bay is now also known as Tasman Bay, and Massacre Bay is supposed to be a smaller bay in it, on the northwestern side.
Before I quit this land altogether, I shall give a short general description of the country, its inhabitants, their manners, customs, etc., in which it is necessary to observe that many things are founded only on conjecture, for we were too short a time in any one place to learn much of their interior policy, and therefore could only draw conclusions from what we saw at different times. Description of New Zealand. Some account of New Zealand. Part of the east,
this should be west coast.
Coast of this country was first discovered by Abel Tasman in 1642, and by him called New Zealand. He, however, never landed upon it. Probably he was discouraged from it by the natives killing 3 or 4 of his people at the first and only place he anchored at. This country, which before now was thought to be a part of the imaginary southern continent, consists of 2 large islands. Divided from each other by a straighter passage of 4 or 5 leagues broad. They are situated between the latitude of 34 and 48 degrees south, and between the longitude of 181 and 194 degrees west from the meridian of Greenwich. The situation of few parts of the world are better determined than these islands are, being settled by some hundreds of observations of the sun and moon, and one of the transit of Mercury made by Mr. Green, who was sent out by the Royal Society to observe the transit of Venus. The northernmost of these islands, as I have before observed, is called by the natives Ahenamau and the southernmost Tovi Panamu. The former name, we were well assured, comprehends the whole of the northern island, but we were not so well satisfied with the latter, whether it comprehended the whole of the southern islands, or only a part of it. This last, according to the natives of Queen Charlotte's Sound, ought to consist of two islands, one of which at least we were to have sailed round in a few days, but this was not verified by our own observations. I am inclinable to think that they know no more of this land than what came within the limits of their sight.
As before remarked, the natives at Queen Charlotte's Sound doubtless were speaking of the large peninsula and the islands which lie west of the sound. There is a spot at the isthmus where canoes could be hauled over.
The chart, see copy of this chart, which I have drawn will best point out the figure and extent of these islands, the situation of the bays and harbors they contain, and the lesser islands lay about them. And now I have mentioned the chart, I shall point out such places as are drawn with sufficient accuracy to be depended upon and such as are not, beginning at Cape Palliser and proceed round the Ahenamau by the East Cape, etc. The coast between these two capes I believe to be laid down pretty accurate, both in its figure and the course and distance from point to point. The opportunities I had, and the methods I made use on to obtain these requisites were such as could hardly admit of an error. From the East Cape to Cape Maria Van Diemen, although it cannot be perfectly true, yet it is without any very material error. Some few places, however, must be excepted, and these are very doubtful, and are not only here, but in every other part of the chart pointed out by a pricked or broken line. From Cape Maria Van Diemen up as high as the latitude of 36 degrees 15 minutes we seldom were nearer the shore than from 5 to 8 leagues, and therefore the line of the sea coast may in some places be erroneous. From the above latitude to nearly the length of Entry Island we run along and near the shore all the way, and no circumstance occurred that made me liable to commit any material error. Except in Cape Tiraut, we never came near the shore between Entry Island and Cape Palliser, and therefore this part of the coast may be found to differ something from the truth. In short, I believe that this island will never be found to differ materially from the figure I have given it, and that the coast affords few or no harbors, but what are either taken notice of in this journal, or in some measure pointed out in the chart. But I cannot say so much for Tovi Panamu. The season of the year and circumstance of the voyage would not permit me to spend so much time about this island as I had done at the other, and the blowing weather we frequently met with made it both dangerous and difficult to keep upon the coast. However, I shall point out the places that may be erroneous in this as I have done in the other. From Queen Charlotte's Sound to Cape Campbell, and as far to the southwest as the latitude 43 degrees, will be found to be pretty accurate. Between this latitude and the latitude 44 degrees 20 minutes the coast is very doubtfully laid down, a part of which we hardly, if at all, saw. From this last mentioned latitude to Cape Saunders we were generally at too great a distance to be particular, and the weather at the same time was unfavorable. The coast, as it is laid down from Cape Saunders to Cape South, and even to Cape West, is no doubt in many places very erroneous, as we hardly were ever able to keep near the shore, and were sometimes blown off altogether. From the West Cape down to Cape Farewell, and even to Queen Charlotte's Sound, will in most places be found to differ not much from the truth.
Cook's open and plain statement, as to the comparative accuracy of different parts of his chart, is much to be commended. It has been too much the fashion with first explorers to leave such matters to be discovered by the student. but the astonishing accuracy of his outline of New Zealand must be the admiration of all who understand the difficulties of laying down a coast, and when it is considered that this coastline is 2,400 miles in extent, the magnitude of the task will be realized by everybody. Never has a coast been so well laid down by a first explorer, and it must have required unceasing vigilance and continual observation, in fair weather and foul, to arrive at such a satisfactory conclusion. And with such a dull sailor as the Endeavour was, the 6.5 months occupied in the work must be counted as a short interval in which to do it.
Animals, timber, etc., New Zealand. Mention is likewise made in the chart of the appearance, or aspect of the face of the country. With respect to Tovi Panamu, it is for the most part very mountainous, and to all appearance a barren country. The people in Queen Charlotte's Sound, those that came off to us from under the snowy mountain, and the 5 we saw to the southwest of Cape Saunders, were all the inhabitants, or signs of inhabitants, we saw upon the whole island, but most part of the sea coast of Ahenamau, except the southwest side, is well inhabited. And although it is a hilly, mountainous country, yet the very hills and mountains are many of them covered with wood, and the soil of the plains and valleys appeared to be very rich and fertile, and such as we had an opportunity to examine we found to be so, and not very much encumbered with woods. It was the opinion of everybody on board that all sorts of European grain, fruit, plants, etc., would thrive here. In short, was this country settled by an industrious people, they would very soon be supplied, not only with the necessaries, but many of the luxuries of life. The sea, bays, and rivers abound with a great variety of excellent fish, the most of them unknown in England, besides lobsters, which were allowed by everyone to be the best they ever had eat. Oysters and many other sorts of shellfish, all excellent in their kind. Sea and water fowls of all sorts are, however, in no great plenty. Those known in Europe are ducks, shags, gannets, and gulls, all of which were eaten by us, and found exceeding good. Indeed, hardly anything came amiss to us that could be eaten by man. Land fowl are likewise in no great plenty, and all of them, except quails, are, I believe, unknown in Europe. These are exactly like those we have in England. The country is certainly destitute of all sorts of beasts, either wild or tame, except dogs and rats. The former are tame, and live with the people, who breed and bring them up for no other purpose than to eat, and rats are so scarce, that not only I, but many others in the ship, never see one. Although we have seen some few seals, and once a sea lion upon this coast, yet I believe they are not only very scarce.
There are a good many seals round the southern part of New Zealand, and a regular fishery is now established on Stewart Island. Cook saw nothing of the few natives that occupied the southern parts of the island,
but seldom or ever come ashore, for if they did, the natives would certainly find out some method of killing them, the skins of which they no doubt would preserve for clothing, as well as the skins of dogs and birds, the only skins we ever saw among them. But they must sometimes get whales, because many of the patapatoas are made of the bones of some such fish, and an ornament they wear at their breast on which they set great value, which are supposed to be made of the tooth of a whale, and yet we know of no method or instrument they have to kill these animals. In the woods are plenty of excellent timber, fit for all purposes except ship's masts. And perhaps upon a close examination some might be found not improper for that purpose. There grows spontaneously everywhere a kind of very broad-bladed grass, like flax of the nature of hemp.
The New Zealand flax, Phormium tenax,
is now a considerable article of commerce. It furnishes a very strong fiber, and is made into rope, etc., of which might be made the very best of cordage and canvas, etc. There are two sorts, one finer than the other. Of these the natives make cloth, rope, lines, nets, etc. Iron ore is undoubtedly to be found here. particularly about Mercury Base, where we found great quantities of iron sand. However, we met with no ore of any sort, neither did we ever see any sort of metal with the natives. We met with some stones at Admiralty Bay that appeared to be mineral in some degree, but Dr. Solander was of opinion that they contained no sort of metal.
Gold and coal have been found in New Zealand in large quantities. Gold at Otago and Takataka in the South Island, and at Thames in the North. The coal fields round the Grey River are enormous, and have no doubt a great future. And this useful mineral is also found in the Bay of Islands, and other places in the North Island. Other metals, as copper, silver, antimony, have also been found and worked.
The white stone we saw near the South Cape, and some other parts to the southward, which I took to be a kind of marble, such as I had seen on one of the hills I was upon in Mercury Bay, Mr. Banks, I afterwards found, was of opinion that they were mineral to the highest degree. He is certainly a much better judge of these things than I am, and therefore I might be mistaken in my opinion, which was only founded on what I had before seen, not only in this country, but in other parts where I have been. And at the same time I must observe we were not less than 6 or 8 leagues from the land, and nearer it was not possible for us at that time to come without running the ship into apparent danger. However, I am no judge how far mineral can be distinguished as such. Certain it is that in southern parts of this country there are whole mountains of nothing else but stone, some of which, no doubt, may be found to contain metal. Should it ever become an object of settling this country, the best place for the first fixing of a colony would be either in the River Thames or the Bay of Islands, for at either of these places they would have the advantage of a good harbor, and by means of the former an easy communication would be had, and settlements might be extended into the inland parts of the country. For a very little trouble and expense small vessels might be built in the river proper for the navigation thereof. It is too much for me to assert how little water a vessel ought to draw to navigate this river, even so far up as I was in the boat. This depends entirely upon the depth of water, that is upon the bar or flat, that lay before the narrow part of the river, which I had not an opportunity of making myself acquainted with. But I am of opinion that a vessel that draws not above 10 or 12 feet may do it with ease. So far as I have been able to judge of the genius of these people, it does not appear to me to be at all difficult for strangers to form a settlement in this country. They seem to be too much divided among themselves to unite in opposing, by which means, and kind and gentle usage, the colonists would be able to form strong parties among them. The natives of this country are a strong, robust, well-made, active people, rather above than under the common size, especially the men. They are of a very dark brown color, with black hair, thin black beards, and white teeth, and such as do not disfigure their faces by tattooing, etc., have in general very good features. The men generally wear their hair long, combed up, and tied upon the crown of their heads. Some of the women wear it long and loose upon their shoulders, old women especially. Others again wear it cropped short. Their combs are made some of bones, and others of wood. They sometimes wear them as an ornament stuck upright in their hair. They seem to enjoy a good state of health, and many of them live to a good old age.
The Maoris were remarkable for longevity, and for health and strength in old age.
Many of the old, and some of the middle-aged men have their faces marked or tattooed with black, and some few we have seen who have had their buttocks, thighs, and other parts of their bodies marked, but this is less common. The figures they mostly use are spirals, drawn and connected together with great nicety and judgment. They are so exact in the application of these figures, that no difference can be found between the one side of the face and the other, if the whole is marked, for some have only one side, and some a little on both sides. Hardly any but the old men have the whole tattooed. From this I conclude, that it takes up some time, perhaps years, to finish the operation, which all who have begun may not have perseverance enough to go through, as the manner in which it must be done, must certainly cause intolerable pain, and may be the reason why so few are marked at all, at least I know no other. The women inlay the color of black under the skins of their lips, and both sexes paint their faces and bodies at times more or less with red ochre, mixed with fish oil. Clothing of New Zealanders. Their common clothing are very much like square thrummed mats, that are made of rope yarns, to lay at the doors or passages in two houses, to clean one's shoes upon. These they tie round their necks, the thrummed side out, and are generally large enough to cover the body as low as the knee. They are made with very little preparation of the broad grass plant before mentioned. Beside the thrummed mats, as I call them, they have other much finer clothing, made of the same plant after it is bleached, and prepared in such a manner that it is as white, and almost as soft as flax, but much stronger. Of this they make pieces of cloth about 5 feet long and 4 broad. These are wove some pieces close and others very open. The former are as stout as the strongest sail cloth, and not unlike it, and yet it is all worked, or made by hand with no other instrument than a needle or bodkin. To one end of every piece is generally worked a very neat border of different colors of 4 or 6 inches broad, and they very often trim them with pieces of dogskin or bird's feathers. These pieces of cloth they wear as they do the other, tying one end round their necks with a piece of string, to one end of which is fixed a needle or bodkin made of bone, by means of which they can easily fasten, or put the string through any part of the cloth. They sometimes wear pieces of this kind of cloth round their middles, as well as over their shoulders. But this is not common, especially with the men, who hardly ever wear anything round their middles, observing no sort of decency in that respect. Neither is it at all uncommon for them to go quite naked without any one thing about them besides a belt round their waists, to which is generally fastened a small string, which they tie round the prepuce. In this manner I have seen hundreds of them come off to and on board the ship, but they generally had their proper clothing in the boat along with them to put on if it rained, etc. The women, on the other hand, always wear something round their middle, generally a short, thrummed mat, which reaches as low as their knees. Sometimes, indeed, I have seen them with only a bunch of grass or plants before, tied on with a piece of fine plaiting made of sweet-scented grass. They likewise wear a piece of cloth over their shoulders as the men do. This is generally of the thrum kind. I hardly ever saw a woman wear a piece of fine cloth. One day at Tolago I saw strong proof that the women never appear naked, at least before strangers. Some of us happened to land upon a small island, where several of them were naked in the water, gathering of lobsters and shellfish. As soon as they saw some of them hid themselves among the rocks, and the rest remained in the sea until they had made themselves aprons of the seaweed. And even then, when they came out to us, they shewed manifest signs of shame, and those who had no method of hiding their nakedness would by no means appear before us. The women have all very soft voices, and may by that alone be known from the men. The making of cloth and all other domestic work is, I believe, wholly done by them, and the more laborious work, such as building boats, houses, tilling the ground, etc., by the men. Both men and women wear ornaments at their ears, and about their necks. These are made of stone, bone, shells, etc., and are variously shaped. And some I have seen wear human teeth and fingernails, and I think we were told that they did belong to their deceased friends. The men, when they are dressed, generally wear 2 or 3 long white feathers stuck upright in their hair, and at Queen Charlotte's Sound many, both men and women, wore round caps made of black feathers. War practices of New Zealanders. The old men are much respected by the younger, who seem to be governed and directed by them on most occasions. We at first thought that they were united under one head or chief, whose name is Te Rātou, We first heard of him in Poverty Bay, and he was owned as chief by everyone we met with from Cape Kidnappers to the northward, and westward as far as the Bay of Plenty, which is a great extent of territories for an Indian prince. When we were upon the east coast, they always pointed inland to the westward for the place of his residence, which I believe to be in the Bay of Plenty, and that those hippas or fortified towns are barrier towns either for or against him. But most likely the former, and if so, maybe the utmost extent of his dominions to the westwards. For at Mercury Bay they did not own him as their prince, nor nowhere else either to the westward or southward, or any other single person. For at whatever place we put in at, or whatever people we spoke with upon the coast, they generally told us that those that were at a little distance from them were their enemies. From which it appeared to me that they were very much divided in two parties, which make war one with another, and all their actions and behavior towards us tended to prove that they are a brave, open, warlike people, and void of treachery. Whenever we were visited by any number of them that had never heard or seen anything of us, before they generally came off in the largest canoe they had, some of which will carry 60, 80, or 100 people. They always brought their best clothes along with them, which they put on as soon as they came near the ship. In each canoe were generally an old man, in some two or three. These used always to direct the others, were better clothed, and generally carried a halberd or battle axe in their hands, or some such like thing that distinguished them from the others. As soon as they came within about a stone's throw of the ship, they would there lay, and call out, "Haromo I herndai patuago," that is, "Come here, come ashore with us, and we will kill you with our patu patus," and at the same time, would shake them at us. At times they would dance the war dance, and other times they would trade with and talk to us, and answer such questions as were put to them with all the calmness imaginable, and then again begin the war dance, shaking their paddles, patu patus, etc., and make strange contortions at the same time. As soon as they had worked themselves up to a proper pitch, they would begin to attack us with stones and darts, and oblige us, whether we would or no, to fire upon them. Musketry they never regarded, unless they felt the effect, but great guns they did, because they threw stones farther than they could comprehend. After they found that our arms were so much superior to theirs, and that we took no advantage of that superiority, and a little time given them to reflect upon it, they ever after were our very good friends, and we never had an instance of their attempting to surprise or cut off any of our people when they were ashore. Opportunity for so doing they must have had at one time or another. It is hard to account for what we have everywhere been told of their eating their enemies killed in battle, which they most certainly do. Circumstances enough we have seen to convince us of the truth of this. Tupia, who holds this custom in great aversion, hath very often argued with them against it, but they have always as strenuously supported it, and never would own that it was wrong. It is reasonable to suppose that men with whom this custom is found, seldom, if ever, give quarter to those they overcome in battle, and if so, they must fight desperately to the very last. A strong proof of this supposition we had from the people of Queen Charlotte's Sound, who told us, but a few days before we arrived, that they had killed and eaten a whole boat's crew. Surely a single boat's crew, or at least a part of them, when they found themselves beset and overpowered by numbers, would have surrendered themselves prisoners was such a thing practiced among them. The heads of these unfortunate people they preserved as trophies. Four or five of them, they brought off to shoot us, one of which Mr. Banks bought, or rather forced them to sell, for they parted with it with the utmost reluctancy, and afterwards would not so much as let us see one more for anything we could offer them. In the article of food these people have no great variety. Fern roots, dogs, fish, and wild fowl is their chief diet, for cocos, yams, and sweet peatos is not cultivated everywhere. They dress their victuals in the same manner as the people in the South Sea Islands, That is, dogs and large fish they bake in a hole in the ground, and small fish, birds, and shellfish, etc., they broil on the fire. Fern roots they likewise heat over the fire, then beat them out flat upon a stone with a wooden mallet. After this they are fit for eating, in the doing of which they suck out the moist and glutinous part, and spit out the fibrous parts. These ferns are much like, if not the same as, the mountain ferns in England. They catch fish with shawms, hooks and line, but more commonly with hoop nets very ingeniously made. In the middle of these they tie the bait, such as sea ears, fish guts, etc., then sink the net to the bottom with a stone. After it lays there a little time they haul it gently up, and hardly ever without fish, and very often a large quantity. All their nets are made of the broad grass plant before mentioned, generally with no other preparation than by splitting the blade of the plant in two threads. Their fish hooks are made of crooked pieces of wood, bones, and shells. New Zealand canoes, houses, etc. The people shew great ingenuity and good workmanship in the building and framing their boats or canoes. They are long and narrow, and shaped very much like a New England whale boat. Their large canoes are, I believe, built wholly for war, and will carry from 40 to 80, or 100 men with their arms, etc. I shall give the dimensions of one which I measured that lay ashore at Tolago. Length 68.12 feet, breadth 5 feet, and depths 3.12, the bottom sharp, inclining to a wedge, and was made of three pieces hollowed out to about 2 inches, or an inch and a half thick, and well fastened together with strong plating. Each side consisted of one plank only, which was 63 feet long and 10 or 12 inches broad, and about 1¼ inch thick, and these were well fitted and lashed to the bottom part. There were a number of thwarts laid across, and lashed to each gunwale as a strengthening to the boat. The head ornament projected 5 or 6 feet without the body of the boat, and was 4 feet high. The stern ornament was 14 feet high, about 2 feet broad, and about 1½ inch thick. It was fixed upon the stern of the canoe like the stern post of a ship upon her keel. The ornaments of both head and stern, and the two sideboards were of carved work, and, in my opinion, neither ill-designed nor executed. All their canoes are built after this plan, and few are less than 20 feet long. Some of the small ones we have seen without riggers, but this is not common. In their war canoes they generally have a quantity of bird's feathers hung in strings, and tied about the head and stern as additional ornament. They are as various in the heads of their canoes as we are in those of our shipping, but what is most common is an odd designed figure of a man, with as ugly a face as can be conceived, a very large tongue sticking out of his mouth, and large white eyes made of the shells of sea ears. Their paddles are small, light, and neatly made. They hardly ever make use of sails, at least that we saw, and those they have, are but ill contrived, being generally a piece of netting spread between two poles, which serve for both masts and yards. The houses of these people are better calculated for a cold than a hot climate. They are built low, and in the form of an oblong square. The framing is of wood or small sticks, and the sides and covering of thatch made of long grass. The door is generally at one end, and no bigger than to admit of a man to creep in and out. Just within the door is the fireplace, and over the door, or on one side, is a small hole to let out the smoke. These houses are 20 or 30 feet long, others not above half as long. This depends upon the largeness of the family they are to contain, for I believe few families are without such a house as these, although they do not always live in them, especially in the summer season, when many of them live dispersed up and down in little temporary huts that are not sufficient to shelter them from the weather. The tools which they work with in building their canoes, houses, etc., are adzes or axes, some made of a hard black stone, and others of green talk. They have chisels made of the same, but these are more commonly made of human bones. In working small work and carving, I believe they use mostly pieces of jasper, breaking small pieces from a large lump they have for that purpose. As soon as the small piece is blunted, they throw it away and take another. To till or turn up the ground, they have wooden spades,
if I may so call them,
made like stout pickets, with a piece of wood tied across near the lower end, to put the foot upon to force them into the ground. These green talk axes, that are whole and good, they set much value upon, and never would part with them for anything we could offer.
The weapons of greenstone, found in the South Islands, were much prized. This hard material required years to shape into a mere, or short club, and these were handed down from father to son as a most valuable possession.
I offered one day for one of the best axes I had in the ship, besides a number of other things, but nothing would induce the owner to part with it. From this I inferred that good ones were scarce among them. Diversions and musical instruments they have but few. The latter consists of two or three sorts of trumpets, and a small pipe or whistle, and the former in singing and dancing. Their songs are harmonious enough, but very doleful to a European ear. In most of their dances they appear like madmen, jumping and stamping with their feet, making strange contortions with every part of the body, and a hideous noise at the same time. And if they happen to be in their canoes, they flourish with great agility their paddles, patoo-patoos, various ways, in the doing of which, if there are ever so many boats and people, they all keep time and motion together to a surprising degree. It was in this manner that they worked themselves to a proper pitch of courage before they used to attack us, and it was only from their after behavior that we could tell whether they were in jest or in earnest when they gave these heavas, as they call them, of their own accord, especially at our first coming into a place. Their signs of friendship as the waving the hand or a piece of cloth, etc., we were never able to learn with any degree of certainty in what manner they bury their dead. We were generally told that they put them in the ground. If so, it must be in some secret or by place, for we never saw the least signs of a burying place in the whole country.
The burying places were kept secret. The body was temporarily buried, and after some time exhumed. The bones were cleaned, and hidden in some cave or cleft in the rocks. As bones were used by enemies to make implements, it was a point to keep these depositories secret, to prevent such desecration.
Their custom of mourning for a friend or relation is by cutting and scarifying their bodies, particularly their arms and breasts, in such a manner that the scars remain indelible, and, I believe, have some signification such as to shew how near related the deceased was to them. Marai and Tahitai words. With respect to religion, I believe these people trouble themselves very little about it. They, however, believe that there is one supreme god, whom they call Tani,
probably Tain Mahuta, the creator of animal and vegetable life. The Marai does not pray.
And likewise a number of other inferior deities, but whether or no they worship or pray to either one or the other we know, not with any degree of certainty. It is reasonable to suppose that they do, and I believe it, yet I never saw the least action or thing among them that tended to prove it. They have the same notions of the creation of the world, mankind, etc., as the people of the South Sea Islands have. Indeed, many of their notions and customs are the very same. But nothing is so great a proof of their all having had one source as their language, which differ but in a very few words the one from the other, as will appear from the following specimens, which I had from Mr. Banks, who understands their language as well, or better than, anyone on board. Column 1. English. Column 2. New Zealand. Column 3. South Sea Islands. A chief colon irit colon ear. A man colon tata. A woman colon ivahina colon ivahin. The head colon upo. The hair colon makov colon comma dot the ear colon taringa colon teria. The forehead colon eri. The eyes colon madu. The cheek colon paparinga colon paparia. The nose colon ahu. The mouth colon ano to colon o to. The chin colon akawai colon comma dot the teeth colon anihu colon nihio. The arm colon aringaringu colon rima. The finger colon madakara colon manio. The belly colon atarabu colon obu. The navel colon apedo colon pedo. Come here colon aromai colon aromai. Fish colon ika colon eka. A lobster colon kuura colon tuura. Cacos colon taro colon taro. Sweet piatos colon kumala colon kumala. Yams colon tufu colon tufu. Birds colon manu colon manu. The wind colon meba colon matai. A thief colon amatu colon tito. To examine colon madicte colon matebai. To sin colon eva colon eva. Bad colon kino colon ino. Trees colon oratu colon ereu. Grandfather colon tabauna colon tabauna. Friend colon comma colon tayo. No colon kaura colon our. Number 1 colon tahai colon tahai. Number 2 colon rua colon rua. Number 3 colon toru colon toru. Number 4 colon a colon e. Number 5 colon rima colon remo. Number 6 colon ono colon ono. Number 7 colon edu. Number 8 colon weru. Number 9 colon iva. Number 10 colon anga auru colon auru. What do you call this or that? Colon oitera. Speculations on a southern continent. Right bracket, there are some small differences in the language spoke by the Ahanamoyans and those of Tovipanamu, but this difference seemed to me to be only in the pronunciation, and is no more than what we find between one part of England and another. What is here inserted as a specimen is that spoke by the people of Ahanamau. What is meant by the South Sea Islands are those islands we ourselves touched at. But I gave it that title, because we have always been told that the same language is universally spoke by all the islanders, and that this is a sufficient proof that both they and the New Zealanders have had one origin or source, but where this is even time perhaps may never discover. It certainly is neither to the southward nor eastward, for I cannot persuade myself that ever they came from America. And as to a southern continent, I do not believe any such thing exists, unless in a high latitude. But as the contrary opinion hath for many years prevailed, and may yet prevail, it is necessary I should say something in support of mine more than what will be directly pointed out by the track of this ship in those seas. For from that alone it will evidently appear that there is a large space extending quite to the tropic in which we were not, or any other before us, that we can ever learn for certain. In our route to the northward, after doubling Cape Horn, when in the latitude of 40 degrees, we were in the longitude of 110 degrees, and in our return to the southward, after leaving Ulietea, when in the same latitude, we were in the longitude of 145 degrees. The difference in this latitude is 35 degrees of longitude. In the latitude of 30 degrees the difference of the two tracks is 21 degrees, and that difference continues as low as 20 degrees. But a view of the chart will best illustrate this. Here is now room enough for the North Cape of the southern continent to extend to the northward, even to a pretty low latitude. But what foundation have we for such a supposition? None, that I know of, but this, that it must either be here or nowhere. Geographers have indeed laid down part of Quiro's discoveries in this longitude, and have told us that he had these signs of a continent, a part of which they have actually laid down in the maps, but by what authority I know not. Quiros, in the latitude of 25 or 26 degrees south, discovered two islands, which, I suppose, may lay between the longitude of 130 and 140 degrees west. Dalrymple lays them down in 146 degrees west, and says that Quiros saw to the southward very large hanging clouds and a very thick horizon, with other known signs of a continent. Other accounts of their voyage, says not a word about this, But supposing this to be true, hanging clouds and a thick horizon are certainly no signs of a continent. I have had many proofs to the contrary in the course of this voyage. Neither do I believe that Quiros looked upon such things as known signs of land, for if he had, he certainly would have stood to the southward, in order to have satisfied himself, before he had gone to the northward, for no man seems to have had discoveries more at heart than he had. Besides this, this was the ultimate object of his voyage.
It is conjectured that what Quiros saw was Tahiti, but his track on this voyage is very vague. There are certainly no islands in the latitude given except Pitcairn.
If Quiros was in the latitude of 26 degrees and longitude 146 degrees west, then I am certain that no part of the southern continent can nowhere extend so far to the northward as the above-mentioned latitude. But the voyage which seems to thrust it farthest back in the longitude I am speaking of, viz., between 130 and 150 degrees west, is that of Admiral Roggewein, a Dutchman, made in 1722, who, after leaving Juan Fernandez, went in search of Davis's Island, but not finding it, he ran 12 degrees more to the west, and in the latitude of 28.12 degrees discovered Easter Island. Dalrymple and some others have laid it down in 27 degrees south, and 106 degrees 30 minutes west, and supposes it to be the same as Davis's Isle, which I think cannot be from the circumstance of the voyage. On the other hand, Mr. Pingree, in his treatise concerning the transit of Venus, gives an extract of Roggewein's voyage, and a map of the South Seas, wherein he places Easter Island in the latitude of 28.12 degrees south, and in the longitude of 123 degrees west.
Easter Island is in longitude 110 degrees west, and is considered identical with Davis's Island.
His reason for so doing may be seen at large in the said treatise. He likewise lays down Roggewein's route through those South Seas very different from any other author I have seen. For after leaving Easter Island he makes him to steer southwest to the height of 34 degrees south, and afterwards west-northwest. If Roggewein really took this route, then it is not probable that there is any mainland to the northward of 35 degrees south. However, Mr. Dalrymple and some geographers have laid down Roggewein's track very different from Mr. Pingree. From Easter Isle they have laid down his track to the northwest, and afterwards very little different from that of Lemaire, and this I think is not probable, that a man who, at his own request, was sent to discover the southern continent should take the same route through these seas as others had done before who had the same thing in view. By so doing he must be morally certain of not finding what he was in search of, and of course must fail as they had done. Be this as it may, it is a point that cannot be cleared up from the published accounts of the voyage, which, so far from taking proper notice of their longitude, have not even mentioned the latitude of several of the islands they discovered, so that I find it impossible to lay down Roggewein's route with the least degree of accuracy.
Roggewein's track is still unknown.
But to return to our own voyage, which must be allowed to have set aside the most, if not all, the arguments and proofs that have been advanced by different authors to prove that there must be a southern continent, I mean to the northward of 40 degrees south, for what may lie to the southward of that latitude I know not. Certain it is that we saw no visible signs of land, according to my opinion, neither in our route to the northward, southward, or westward, until a few days before we made the coast of New Zealand. It is true we have often seen large flocks of birds, but they were generally such as are always seen at a very great distance from land. We likewise saw frequently pieces of sea or rock weed, but how is one to know how far this may drive to sea? I am told, and that from undoubted authority, that there is yearly thrown up upon the coast of Ireland and Scotland a sort of beans called oxeyes, which are known to grow nowhere but in the West Indies, and yet these two places are not less than 1,200 leagues asunder. Was such things found floating upon the water in the South Seas, one would hardly be persuaded that one was even out of sight of land. So apt are we to catch at everything that may at least point out to us the favorite object we are in pursuit of. And yet experience shews that we may be as far from it as ever. Thus I have given my opinion freely and without prejudice, not with any view to discourage any future attempts being made towards discovering the southern continent. On the contrary, as I think this voyage will evidently make it appear, that there is left but a small space to the northward of 40 degrees, where the grand object can lay. I think it would be a great pity that this thing, which at times has been the object of many ages and nations, should not now be wholly be cleared up, which might very easily be done in one voyage without either much trouble, or danger or fear of miscarrying, as the navigator would know where to go to look for it. But if, after all, no continent was to be found, then he might turn his thoughts towards the discovery of those multitude of islands which, we are told, lay within the tropical regions to the south of the line, and this we have from very good authority, as I have before hinted. This he will always have in his power, for, unless he be directed to search for the southern lands in a high latitude, he will not, as we were, be obliged to go farther to the westward in the latitude of 40 degrees than 140, or 145 degrees west, and therefore will always have it in his power to go to George's Island, where he will be sure of meeting with refreshments to recruit his people, before he sets out upon the discovery of the islands.
Cook carried out this program in his second voyage, when he set at rest forever the speculation regarding the southern continent.
But should it be thought proper to send a ship out upon this service while Tupia lives, and he to come out in her, in that case she would have a prodigious advantage over every ship that hath been upon discoveries in those seas before. For by means of Tupia, supposing he did not accompany you himself, you would always get people to direct you from island to island, and would be sure of meeting with a friendly reception and refreshment at every island you came to. This would enable the navigator to make his discoveries the more perfect and complete. At least it would give him time so to do, for he would not be obliged to hurry through those seas through any apprehensions of wanting provisions. Tupia's list of islands. I shall now add a list of those islands which Tupia and several others have given us an account of, and endeavor to point out the respective situations from Otaheite, or George's Island. But this, with respect to many of them, cannot be depended upon. Those marked thus, Tupia himself has been at, and we have no reason to doubt his veracity in this, by which it will appear that his geographical knowledge of those seas is pretty extensive. And yet I must observe that, before he came with us, he hardly had an idea of any land being larger than Otaheite. Column 1. Name of the island's northeast quarter. Column 2. Bearings from Otaheite. Upate : between the north and north-northeast. Uura : between the north and north-northeast. Teokoa : between the north and north-northeast. Arivoa : between the north and north-northeast. Ahevapato : between the north and north-northeast. Ada : north-northeast to northeast by north. Ohiveroa : north-northeast to northeast by north. Tamano : north-northeast to northeast by north. Uda : north-northeast to northeast by north. Column 1. Name of the island's southeast quarter. Column 2. Bearings from Otaheite. Mautu : south to southeast. Tumatororo : south to southeast. Tenoamatan : south to southeast. Ahitatamarer : south to southeast. Aurapo : south to southeast. Mighty Rosnaburg Island : east southeast and east. Ahevenu : east southeast and east. Oharada : east southeast and east. Column 1. Name of the island's southwest quarter. Column 2. Bearings from Otaheite. Imaur York Island : west by south and west southwest. Tapu Amanu or Saunders Island : west by south and west southwest. Manua : between the south and southwest. Hanu colon between the south and southwest. Oataroa colon between the south and southwest. Ana colon between the south and southwest. Adeohara colon between the south and southwest. Oparu colon between the south and southwest. Uno colon between the south and southwest. Tiaramadawadia colon between the south and southwest. Titoite colon between the south and southwest. Ohavi colon between the southwest and west southwest. Paramathechua colon between the southwest and west southwest. Timorohit colon between the southwest and west southwest. Ohatadarav colon between the southwest and west southwest. Ohatadariva colon between the southwest and west southwest. Ahidatautamai colon between the southwest and west southwest. Muenateo colon west. Tatupatunio colon west. Ahidatutunadu colon west. Ahidapodo colon west. Column 1. Name of the island's northeast quarter. Column 2. Bearings from Matahiite. Wariva colon northeast. Wadaruro colon northeast. Tidiu colon northeast. Titiniova colon northeast. Tarawa colon northeast. Wawa colon north northeast. Wadareta colon north northeast. Waninia colon north northeast. Ahevatauchua colon east by north. Column 1. Name of the island's northwest quarter. Column 2. Bearings from Matahiite. Tathuroa colon north by west. Una colon north by west. Abaha colon north by west. Mata colon north by west. Huon colon between the north and west. Ulietia colon between the north and west. Ataha colon between the north and west. Balabola colon between the north and west. Tubai colon between the north and west. Morwa colon between the north and west. Apupua colon between the north and west. Opapatia colon between the north and west. Wanuleauta colon between the north by west and west. Matehia colon between the north by west and west. Uurio colon between the north by west and west. Orurutu colon between the north by west and west. Odia colon between the north by west and west. Uhuahu colon between the north by west and west. Oiha colon between the north by west and west. Oratuma colon between the north by west and west. Tanuna colon between the north by west and west. Oravevi colon between the north by west and west. Tatipa colon between the north by west and west. Oratoa colon between the north by west and west. Oravavai colon between the north by west and west. Aru colon between the north by west and west. The above list was taken from a chart of the islands drawn by Tupia's own hands.
This list is hopeless. With the exception of the society group Yuhan, and the names that follow,
Imau Amio, Tapuamanuo, Tathuroa, and Ohataroa, all lying near Tahiti, none can be recognized. Those north and east are no doubt names of the Pamadu group, low coral islands, disposed in rings round lagoons, whose innumerable names are very little known to this day, and very probably the Tahitians had their own names for them. He at one time gave us an account of near 130 islands, but in his chart he laid down only 74, and this is about the number that some others of the natives of Atahiite gave us an account of. But the account taken by and from different people differ sensibly one from another both in names and numbers. The first is owing to the want of rightly knowing how to pronounce the names of the islands after them. But be this as it may, it is very certain that there are these number of islands, and very probably a great many more, laying somewhere in the great South Sea, the greatest part of which have never been seen by any European. Historical notes on New Zealand. Notes on New Zealand. As already stated by Cook in the journal, New Zealand was first discovered by Abel Tasman, a Dutch navigator, in the year 1642. Sailing from Tasmania, he sighted the northern part of the Middle Island, and anchored a little east of Cape Farewell in Massacre Golden Bay, so called by him, because the Maoris cut off one of his boats, and killed three of the crew. Tasman never landed anywhere, but coasted from Massacre Bay along the western side of the North Island to the North Point. He passed outside the Three Kings, and thence away into the Pacific, to discover the Friendly Group. No European eye again sighted New Zealand until Cook circumnavigated and mapped the islands. The warlike character of the natives is well shown in this journal. On nearly every occasion they either made, or attempted to make, an attack, even on the ships, and in self-defense firearms had constantly to be used. Nevertheless, Cook's judgment enabled him to inaugurate friendly relations in most places, where he stopped long enough to enable the natives to become acquainted with the strangers. It was not so with other voyagers. De Surville, a Frenchman, who called at Doubtless Bay very shortly after Cook left it, destroyed a village and carried off a chief. Marion de Fresne was, in 1772, in the Bay of Islands, killed by the natives, with 16 of his people, and eaten, for violation of some of their customs, and ill-treatment of some individuals. Other outrages followed, committed on both sides, and it is no wonder that, though Cook represented the advantages of the island for colonization, it was not considered a desirable place in which to settle. The cannibalism of the Maoris especially made people shy of the country. Intermittent communication took place between New Zealand and the new colony of New South Wales, and at last, in 1814, Samuel Marsden, a clergyman of the Church of England, who had seen Maoris in New South Wales, landed in the Bay of Islands with other missionaries. This fearless and noble-minded man obtained the confidence of the Maoris, and a commencement of colonization was made. It was not, however, until 1840 that the New Zealand Company was formed to definitely colonize. They made their station at Wellington. In the same year Captain Hobson, R.N.N., was sent as Lieutenant Governor. Landing first at the Bay of Islands, he transferred his headquarters to the Horaiti Gulf in September 1840, where he founded Auckland, which remained the capital until 1876, when the seat of government was transferred to Wellington. The North Island, in which all these occurrences took place, contained by far the greater number of the natives, and it seems strange now that the first efforts to settle were not made in the Middle Island, which has proved equally suitable for Europeans, and where the difficulties of settlement, from the existence of a less numerous native population, were not so great. It is not necessary here to follow the complicated history of New Zealand in later years, which unfortunately comprises several bloody wars with the Maoris. The present prosperous condition of this great colony is well known, but it has not been affected without the rapid diminution of the natives, who have met with the fate of most Aborigines in contact with Europeans, especially when the former were naturally bold and warlike. The Maoris have retained the tradition of the original arrival of their race in a fleet of canoes from a country called Hawaiki, which is by some supposed to be Hawaii in the Sandwich group. As we have seen, the language was practically the same as that of Tahiti, and there is no doubt that they came from some of the Polynesian islands. The date of the immigration is supposed to be the 15th century. Each canoe's crew settled in different parts of the North Island, and were the founders of the different great tribes into which the New Zealanders were divided. The more celebrated canoes were the Arawa, Tainui, Aotea, Kurahapo, Takatumu, and others. The Arawa claimed the first landing, and the principal idols came in her. One of these is now in the possession of Sir George Grey. A large tribe on the east coast still bears the name of Arawa, and her name, that of the Tainui, and other of the canoes, are now borne by some of the great steamships that run to New Zealand. Cook, in the voyage with which we have to deal, completely examined the whole group. His pertinacity and determination to follow the whole coast is a fine instance of his thoroughness in exploration. No weather nor delay daunted him, and the accuracy with which he depicted the main features of the outline of the islands is far beyond any of the similar work of other voyagers. It is true that he missed in the South Island many of the fine harbors that have played such an important part in the prosperity of the colony. But when we consider the narrowness of their entrances, and the enormous extent of the coastline which he laid down in such a short time, this is not astonishing. His observations on the natives and on the country display great acuteness of observation, and at the settlers displayed the same spirit of fair treatment and respect for the customs of the natives. Much of the bloody warfare that has stained the annals of the colony might have been averted, though it is scarcely possible that with such a high-spirited race the occupation of the islands, especially the North Island, where the majority of the Maoris were, could have taken place without some disturbances. New Zealand now contains 630,000 Europeans and 41,000 Maoris. Its exports are valued at £10,000, and the imports at £6,250,000. There are 2,000 miles of railways open. Such is the result of 50 years of colonization in a fertile and rich island, the climate of which may be described as that of a genial England. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.